Hi, this is Doug Podell. Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. Don't forget, while you're online, to check out the Riff Concert page. It's the Motor City's best for complete rock concert information. For more details, just click on the Riff banner on your Windows Media Player.
Agencies and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. The Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome, everybody. Welcome to everybody listening. Most of you, of course, I don't even know anymore. I was going to say most of you are listening in the immediate WRIF listening area of Detroit, Southern Ontario, and Northern Ohio, but with the Internet, who knows? I get mail from all over the world. So wherever you're listening, welcome. If you'd like to call in, since we're really a Detroit show, although we welcome everyone, we don't have a toll-free number. But hey, if you're far away, spend a couple nickels, all right? I mean, isn't it like something like that now, a nickel a minute? 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-WRIF. If you have email for me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Please, no manifestos, just some short sentences if you'd like to comment or like to open up discussion. In fact, we don't have a topic yet, mainly because I only have been saying hello to you. So, hello. On the rock and roll front, inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Black Sabbath, Miles Davis, and the Sex Pistols. Jazz trumpeter Miles Davis did a lot of jazz rock fusion among five of the musical legends. When I was there in New York at the Waldorf Astoria, no less, where with one of the induction ceremonies, oh man, that was a long time ago, 1999. There at the end of it all, who was there? Was Ray Charles and the Loving Spoonful? Oh yeah. Eric Clapton, Sir Paul, a few people of note. I mean, that's pretty strange to be, you know, like 20 feet from Paul McCartney or 20 feet from Eric Clapton. But we were there, WRIF, yeah, indeed. And who else? Blondie and Lynyrd Skynyrd. Well, I was going to say, at the end of it all, they had a big jam session, and I was thinking, what a great jam session. Black Sabbath, Miles Davis, and the Sex Pistols, right? But I don't know how it would sound if we also put Blondie and Lynyrd Skynyrd in there. What's that song you want to hear? Man, I don't want to hear it. I know, maybe it's your favorite. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on any toes here. But that's the rock news. Let me see, what else? I don't know if this is really rock news, but I saw the rock musical last night, Rent. You know that one? Rent just came out, and it's a story based on Puccini's La Boheme. La Boheme is this famous opera. In fact, I just saw it at the Detroit Opera House, oh, about a month ago. Is it maybe even only 3 weeks ago? Just absolutely stunning. Fabulous. One of the best operas of all. And I know, we've talked about this before. Some of you go, opera? Yeah, man. People go, ah. Boy, those people can sing, and I mean the power in their voices and these great stories. And so Rent was adapted from that. And the story, I think, is set in like the 1840s in Paris, and it's in the Bohemian district where these absolutely poor, starving artists and writers live, and the tragedy of Mimi, who has TB. So this is transported into the late 1980s, into the Lower East Side of New York, where people are infected with AIDS because the disease devastating everyone back in the 1840s was TB, now and a lot of oftentimes, and at that time was AIDS. And I don't know if it's everyone's cup of tea, because someone said that it's sort of Puccini, you know, the opera's author, meets what the hell is his name? I can't even remember it. That's a big, huge guy that sings kind of these real, oh man, I ruined my little thing. I can't think of who it is. It's just right out of my brain. Come on, some of you know who I'm talking about. Something or other by the Dashboard Light. I mean, it's not really what we play here on Riff during the day. Meatloaf, right. So it's Puccini meets Meatloaf. And that might be enough for you guys to say, all right, thanks for the warning. I'm not going there. But it was very touching, very poignant, without being sappy or sentimental. Let's see, what else could I say about it? Its themes about that also, besides, I mean, the main themes were the love affair between Roger and Mimi, but also there was a gay love interest, and it treated AIDS, and when it was first devastating a lot of communities, in a way that I thought was very powerful. Great dancing. Some of it shot on location in the Lower East Side. Some people didn't like it. My friend Curtis Ellis, who does a lot of reviews, theater and movie reviews, he said he knows it's not politically correct, but he said it was the first time in his life that he was ever hoping that people would die of AIDS in the film and kind of get it all over with. I liked it a lot better than that. And I said, Curtis, it's terrible. He said, well, it's not. They're not real people. Right? They're just in the movie. He didn't like it. I liked it. All right. Serious stuff. We're at risk. Isn't that nice? Of all the mistakes Bush Incorporated, Bush Co. has made, the most catastrophic one, although Iraq is catching up in terms of death, so it was September 11th. It was their watch. They had gotten all the warnings. Everyone knew something was coming. And Bush went on vacation. Even on vacation, he got a memo saying Al-Qaeda, or maybe even Osama bin Laden, I can't remember the exact wording, it's not in front of me, preparing to strike in U.S. And so naturally the U.S. went on heightened alert. No, I guess it didn't. Didn't do anything. Here's what the members of the former September 11th Commission, that was the government agency that Bush fought, by the way. You may remember that. He didn't want any commission whatsoever to look into the mistakes, because he thought that his government, and correctly so, would come out looking badly. So anyways, here's what the Associated Press says. The U.S. is at great risk. Let's, sometimes you hear all this. I mean, we're inundated with information and news, but let's kind of focus on some of these words, like our lives depend on them, right? Or other people's lives depend on them. The U.S. is at great risk for more terrorist attacks because Congress and the White House, both Republican-dominated, of course, have failed to enact several strong security measures, according to the members of the former September 11th Commission. The former chairman, Thomas Kane, who is a Republican, he says it's not a priority for the government right now. Yeah, they're just trying to figure out how they cannot get chased out of Iraq and have their political fortunes nosedive even more. That's what they're concerned about. More than 4 years, let's see, this is, the former Republican governor of New Jersey says, more than 4 years after 9/11, people are not paying attention. God help us, he says, if we have another attack. Well, Bush, God bless America, every time he talks. Lee Hamilton, the former Democratic vice chairman of the commission, says, we believe that another attack will occur. It's not a question of if, and we are not as well prepared as we should be. I think they're being kind of nice. Now, I mean, I think this whole terrorist thing is way overblown. I mean, we saw what a really careful planning by really deranged far-right-wing religious fanatics can do on September 11th. We took a terrible blow, And although time does repair all wounds, it's still in our consciousness, not as greatly as certainly as it was. And many of us thought we would never, ever forget that moment. It would always contain that strong emotional element for us. But, of course, time does move on and away from it. Nothing's happened. But there's several hundred of these men out there, and probably a few women as well, committed to carrying out these horrendous acts that we've seen here and in Madrid and London. And everything has to be done as we would to prepare against any criminal assault on the body politic. Well, forget the body politic. On the citizenry, on us, the citizens of the world, whether it's in Bali or Australia or Spain or England or here. We want to have a strong enough mechanism, intelligence and police, that this does not occur to us. I mean, one of the main things we should do is stop the irritants. We would move greatly ahead on this if we would get out of Iraq as soon as absolutely possible. In fact, disengage as much as possible, except on a very peaceable means basis in the Middle East. I'm not trying to say this would necessarily stop it all, but it would go very, very far. And particularly with these people now who increasingly hate us because of our assault on an occupation of Iraq, it would do a lot to defuse this. But we still have to keep our guard up. And the people that are entrusted with this, again, this is again, they do not have their eye on the ball. I mean, how many times are we going to let these jokers get away with it? I don't know how Bush got away with it the first time. I don't know why his popularity, instead of going up to 90%, didn't go but down to 5%. I mean, I probably have said this 100 times. If Al Gore would have been rightly seated in the White House since he won the 2000 election, the Republicans would have moved to impeach him. I mean, hey, look what they did to Clinton over it, next to nothing. So these people cannot be trusted with our safety. They've shown it once, and now the commission, a bipartisan commission, 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, led by a Republican, says the U.S. is at great risk. We've kind of taken our eye off the ball, too, because the ball that our eye is on is always determined by the media and what kind of manner in which the politicians are jerking the media around. Let's see, what else is up? Oh, I like this. I got all this stuff paper-clipped together. Yeah. This is from Eileen Proctor, International Public Relations in New York, and there's a new Zogby International poll. Half of New Yorkers, New York State people, believe U.S. leaders, quote, consciously failed to act on 9/11. 66% call for a new probe of unanswered questions by Congress or New York's Attorney General. The poll is the first of its kind conducted in America that surveys attitudes regarding U.S. Government complicity in the 9/11 tragedy. Despite the acute legal and political implications of this accusation, nearly 30% of registered Republicans and over 38% of those who described themselves as, quote, very conservative, supported the claim. The charge found particularly high support among adults under 30, 62%. Only 36% believed that the 9/11 Commission had, quote, answered all the important questions about what actually happened on September 11th. And 2 in 3 New Yorkers, 66%, called for another full investigation of still unanswered questions by Congress. So, you know, and this is a scary period, too, because you may remember that when Bush's poll numbers began to drop, and I'm not saying that it's necessarily a causal relationship. You draw whatever conclusions you want. There's a lot of this, I don't know, a lot of stuff. I mean, I know we talked about 9/11 a couple of weeks ago, and everybody said this and that, and they had very specific ideas and conspiracies and what have you. And I don't know. It's like the Kennedy assassination. Remember we talked about that, and everybody said it was the CIA or it was the mafia, it was whoever. And someone finally asked me, and I said, I don't know. I know it didn't come down the way the Warren Commission said, and I know it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald, but a lot of this stuff, I mean, there's things to suggest what went on. But we know the official pronouncements are total crap. And that's what I said. Remember I was saying last week a good way to operate when trying to figure out how do you know what's true? People always ask me that. How do I figure out what's true? I hear you, I hear him, I hear this, I hear that. And I said, figure anyone in the public eye is lying. And hey, you can do that with me. All right, Werbe just made a claim It's a lie. All right. It's a lie. It's an absolute lie. Well, all right. But then you have just with you know, the people on television. I mean, there you can see them. They got suits on, so you know not to trust them. But so the president or the newscaster or the guy trying to sell you a car or something like that, it's probably, yeah. I mean, immediately your critical faculty should go up. And if it's something that's going to affect your pocketbook or your lives or your children's lives or something like that, real skepticism ought to come into play. Or you're just a sucker waiting to be plucked. And that's what happened. All right. So 100 times again. Sorry, I'll go through this quickly for those of you who've heard it. September 10th, Bush's poll numbers are dropping completely. Remember, he lost the popular vote. We know that's a fact. All right. The rest of it, whether he stole it, we could argue about. But it's a fact he wasn't real popular enough even to win the popular vote in 2000. All right. So then people immediately gets in and not a unifier, starts carrying out this far right wing agenda. We realize how deeply in bed with Ken Lay and Enron he is. There's all this. I don't want to go over it, but all this stuff like repealing regulations about arsenic in the water, and his popularity starts dropping immensely. So suddenly, September 11th, as he hits the trifecta, as he said, and suddenly he's this Winston Churchill of a president. I mean, he's speaking for the pain and the unity of America. United we stand. George W. Bush, once he stopped running away on September 11th, then he shows up at Ground Zero and all that. All right, so he enjoys a long period of, if you call months, a long period of popularity. But then all of the right-wing agenda and all the giveaways to the rich and we're driven into debt and a hundred other things begin to dawn on people. And then suddenly, and maybe one of you can help me with this, suddenly Bush discovers that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. His popularity is going down. But he suddenly tells us we are under threat. Saddam Hussein is connected up with Al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons on the drawing board. The smoking gun could be a mushroom cloud, all that. There's hundreds of tons of poison gases and anthrax and ricin and the mustard and all that stuff. All right? And that was right around the time that Enron collapsed and it was clear the relationship between Bush and Kenny Boy, as Bush used to call him. So then up go the popularity again. And now it's really down there. About two-thirds of us think he's can't be trusted, that he lies, that he as it said in that what's called the Downing Street memo, that he, how did they put that, sort of rigged the intelligence around the policy. So that all goes on. So now he's rock bottom. He's screwed. He's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. If he goes forward in Iraq towards victory, we're going to just see thousands of more deaths. The Treasury of the United States losing tens of billions of dollars more, hundreds of billions probably. We'd be lucky if it's only tens of billions. If he gets out and the country falls into chaos created by the invasion, then he gets hit for that as well. So what's he going to do? Is there going to be another terrorist attack? I mean, that I don't think that would work for him. I think we'd say, wait a minute, this guy was supposed to protect us and hasn't. Now, Bush gave this speech the other day, was it on Wednesday, for victory, his strategy for victory. Although I think in here, yeah, poll, most doubt Bush has a plan for Iraq victory. As President Bush launched a new effort Wednesday to gain public support for the Iraq war, a new poll found most Americans do not believe he has a plan that will achieve victory. 60% of us said U.S. troops, 35%, got too many percentages in here. 55%, here it is, 55% said they did not believe Bush has a plan that will achieve victory for the United States. 41% said he did. Well, you know, maybe I'd be in the 41%. I believe he has a plan, but I don't think the plan is going to work. I mean, it might work. If you just killed, enough people, and we lost enough men, if we spent enough hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe we could pull this off, but is it worth it? And, You know, I would ask anybody that supports the victory plan to tell me how many American casualties are they willing to suffer and how much money. I mean, 100,000 American casualties? No. All right. 58,000 like in Vietnam? Well, that's a lot. 3,000? We're on the way to 3,000. 5,000? 10,000? How many hundreds of billions? A trillion? So we let everything in this country go to hell? Tell me. What do you think? They're on their way out because there's a real split among the rulers, and a lot of it is coming from the Pentagon. They don't want another Vietnam syndrome to occur, and that's what's on its way. American people aren't going to support these imperial adventures abroad. So they pull out people like Lieutenant General William Odom, and he's the U.S. general who used to head the National Security Agency, and he says the only way to stabilize the Middle East is to leave Iraq. So you notice who's saying this? Well, Cindy Sheehan saying it. What is she now? Or I say it. What is he now? But here we're starting to have these people like John Murtha of Pennsylvania, that these disgusting, repellent to Republicans called a coward. This guy with all these medals from Vietnam and the Marines for 110 years or something like that. So that's who they're putting out there. Murtha, the Pennsylvania congressman, is very close to the Pentagon. Retired three-star Lieutenant General William Odom wrote that while President George W. Bush wants to bring democracy and stability to the Middle East, the only way to achieve that goal is for the U.S. Armed Forces to get out of Iraq now. He says, we have seen most of our allies stand aside. There's no chance that our allies will join us in Iraq. I have two more allies leaving Iraq, more to go, says the Associated Press headline. Remember they called it the Coalition of the Willing? Actually, it's the Coalition of the Billing. I mean, we were giving these people billions and billions of dollars, and a lot more are going to start peeling off as well. Let's see. You know, there is this professor at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and he's one of the world's foremost military historians, and several of his books have influenced modern military theory, and he's the only non-American author on the U.S. Army's list of required reading for officers. Now, in other words, when you are becoming an officer, there's a required list of reading. One of them is to read Martin van Creveld, C-R-E-V-E-L-D, C-R-E-V-E-L-D. He's previously drawn parallels between Iraq and Vietnam and pointed out that almost all countries that have tried to fight similar wars during the last 60 years or so have ended up losing. He said, why President Bush nevertheless decided to go to war escapes me and will no doubt preoccupy historians to come. But here's what he said. For misleading, this is the U.S. Army's required author. For misleading the American people and launching the most foolish war since Emperor Augustus in 9 BC sent his legions into Germany and lost them, Bush deserves to be impeached, and once he has been removed from office, put on trial along with the rest of the president's men. Well, I wonder if he'll be required reading any longer at West Point. Now, two famous men in history, Theodore C. Sorensen and Arthur Schlesinger Jr., both were assistants to President Kennedy. So these guys must be pretty elderly by now. And so they had this victory. Did you see any of that, by the way, the victory podium? You know, when I look at that, because here at WRIF we do a lot of promotions, and there's a budget for promotions because we need signs and booths and bumper stickers and, you know, stuff like that. Anybody who's been to a WRIF event knows what's out there. And we want to present ourselves in the best possible way, and it costs money to do this. And there's, you go to like to the auto show that's coming up in January, and radio stations really pump thousands and thousands of dollars into their display. So here's Bush standing in front of this enormous dais with all over these huge, with huge signage saying victory in Iraq or strategy for victory. And as soon as I look at that, first thing I think of, man, we're paying for that. This is campaigning. This is partisan campaigning for this war, and you and me are footing the bill. I mean, every time you see I mean, look at this from now on. Every time you see Bush particularly, like when he had mission accomplished, remember that? That big sign? Well, again, we paid for that. They had the Pentagon, had contractors and all that. Anyway, Sorensen and Schlesinger in today's New York Times say what we did not hear from President Bush when he spoke last week at the United States Naval Academy about his strategy for victory in Iraq. Where is it? In other words, a question. We did not hear that the war in Iraq, already one of the costliest wars in American history, is a running sore. We did not hear that it's taken more than 2,000 precious American lives and countless, because we do not count them, Iraqi civilian lives. We do not hear that the struggle has dragged on longer than our involvement in either World War I or the Spanish-American War, or that by next spring it will be even longer than the Korean War. And we did not hear how or when the president plans to bring our forces home. No facts, no numbers on American troop withdrawals, no dates, no reference to our dwindling coalition, no reversal of his disdain for the United Nations, whose help he still expects. Neither our military, or our economy, nor our nation can take that kind of endless and remorseless drain for an only vaguely defined military and political mission. If we leave early, the president said, catastrophe might follow. But Sorensen and Schlesinger say, but what of the catastrophe that we are prolonging and worsening by our continued presence, including our continued unforgivable mistreatment of detainees? Each month that America continues its occupation facilitates Al-Qaeda's recruitment of young Islamic men and women as suicide bombers, the one weapon against which our open society has no pure defense. The president says we should support our troops by staying the course, but who is really willing to support our troops by bringing them safely home? The responsibility for devising an exit plan rests primarily not with the war's opponents, but with the president, who hastily launched a preemptive invasion without enough troops to secure Iraq's borders and arsenals, without enough armor to protect our forces, without enough allied support, and without adequate plans for either a secure occupation or a timely exit. What could be said to refute that? And you see these conservatives. Actually, somebody wrote me. Who is it? Gary from South Bend. He says, we shouldn't call them conservative. We should call them self-servatives. I like that. All right. Here's the deal. Peter Werbe is my name. You're listening to Night Call, WRIF in Detroit. Our number is 313-298-WRIF. And let's take our first call. It's Tad Nipsilani. Hey, Tad, it's Peter Werbe. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Glad you're on the air. It's always always good these days when things are turning around to be able to bounce some things around like this.
Sure.
And one of the things that you've been talking about more that in addition to just helping us understand the litany of things that are going wrong is how we can get to start, you know, getting together in some serious ways to actually, you know, be organized enough to do something with this historic, you know, turn of events here that I think surprising a lot of us how quickly and how massively things are going wrong with the administration. But
well, see. We, the American people, nor the ostensible opposition party, which I always say is really just another party, the Democrats, move in a manner fast enough to take advantage of the events that are occurring as this administration starts circling the drain. I mean, think about the way these rabid dog Republicans got on Clinton for his stupidity. Right, they did not miss a beat. They were just there, and now suddenly you get a few Democrats who are saying, "Well, maybe, you know, maybe we should think about getting out of there." And I mean, the American people oppose the war. The American people think Bush lied. Why isn't there an aggressive move by on the part of the at least of the Democrats? But I don't ever count on them. But so what you're saying, essentially, Ted, how do we organize like people have always organized since the abolitionist movement straight mm-hmm. through the union movements and the anti-war movements of the 60s and all of that? Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I have to say I don't know. Here's why I don't know. The germ of these movements are there in 100 organizations all around. I mean, there's these little small groups that hold rallies. They have online stuff. They have demonstrations. They have meetings. They have speeches. And usually it's what we call the usual suspects show up. In other words, us, the people that all know one another. So, like,
Right, completely leaving out all of the former Bush voters that are now having serious second thoughts. All the people who didn't vote. No, I agree with you. We don't do a good job of this.
Well, I'm not even talking about them. I mean, you're right. I hadn't even thought about that. I'm talking about the people that oppose the war, that oppose Bush. Like, for instance, next Saturday, December 10th, there's going to be an anti-war demonstration put on by a group called Women in Black. And I guarantee you there will be the usual 60 or 70 people there. I'm sorry to say, you'll have to go to my website to see where it is. And this show goes out to tens of thousands of people in the Detroit area, maybe more. I don't know how many for sure. But, I mean, at least 30, 40, 50,000 just in this immediate area. And I would say the people listening, four-fifths of the people listening agree with what I'm saying, and they will not show up. They'll have something else to do. They say, well, I don't like to go to demonstrations. It's too cold. I'm worried about what it'd be like. You know, or will the cops beat us up? All of which is not true. And to some extent, I mean, think what happened to the union movement. In the 1930s, the cops and National Guard and scabs and thugs killed 300 of our grandfathers and our great-grandfathers who wanted to have a union. So, I mean, and there's nothing like this now. I mean, people aren't going to face that kind of opposition.
It's not zero, though. There's better organizing happening in unions. There's the, you know, here in Metro Detroit, there's the Moses organization that's a mix of congregations that are getting some real power that's, you know, got to be a lot bigger, and those groups have to get together. Serious about organizing is the
absolute key to it. And there are so many different websites, but, I mean, you could start with mine and go to my calendar. There's actually not much on there right now, but there's a couple of links to groups that have ongoing stuff. And so anyway, my website is Peter Werbe, PETERWERBE. Someone said I should say B as in boy, WERBE. Ted, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. Let's go on to Chris. Chris is out in Dearborn. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing great.
Well, hey, I just want to bring up a new topic here.
Sure, please. Anytime.
Telegraph and 94.
Well, what is that all about?
You driven by there lately?
Telegraph and 94. Well, they must be doing construction or something. Oh, yeah, they're doing, sure, on the way to the airport.
The arch between the airport and Ford Field.
Okay.
Have you seen it?
No.
Oh. Well, it's not too bad.
Wait. Ford Field. Oh, not the stadium.
Well, it's between the airport and Ford Field.
Okay.
94. The arch suspension bridge.
Okay. No, man. So what is it? I mean, I know the traffic was all messed up. Is that what it's about?
It's basically Honolulu Blue. And, I don't know. It could be a lot better.
You'd like a different color?
No, not so much that. It's that far after the Super Bowl leaves us,
we'll
be stuck with this ugly bridge.
Huh.
Haven't seen it?
No, but I actually have to go to the airport soon. So I got to go to spot. So what's the solution?
Ooh, there isn't one.
Wow, man. We're in trouble. Thank you.
WRIM.com. Tired of expensive phone bills? Standard phone service can cost a minimum of $30. And for the unlimited packages, it's anywhere from $40 to $70. After adding all the taxes and fees, the question is it really worth it? I'd like to introduce you to Corecom's new product, Voice over Internet Protocol, or simply VoIP. This innovation allows you to talk to anyone around the world by using your broadband internet connection. With its advanced features, VoIP is revolutionizing telephone service as we know it today. Even more exciting is that this can all be done at a fraction of the price of traditional phone service. Why would you pay more when you can pay less? If you've got high-speed internet access, Corecom can offer you a package for as low as $15.99 per month. When was the last time your phone company offered you any package options that low? As an added bonus, if you call within the next next 10 minutes, Corecom will throw in 1 month free. All you have to do is call 1-866-680-CORE. That's 1-866-680-CORE. Call now and mention promotion code WRIF, or if you register online, type in promotion code WRIF to get your free month. Corecom, revolutionizing phone service one call at a time.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
Hi, this is Colleen McDonald, president of Holiday Automotive Group. You know us as Holiday Chevrolet in Farmington Hills, Livonia Chrysler Jeep in Livonia, and Century Dodge in Taylor. We know it's never fun to have to bring your car in for service, and worse yet, if you've been in an accident. But rest assured, our service staff is here and ready to help you. To make an appointment, go online at weloveholiday.com. It's that easy.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
We also have special discounts if you need body work on your vehicle and accept all insurance companies. Call us at 866-867-0909 for more information. We're the Holiday Automotive Group. We've got you covered from Downriver to Oakland County.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best Riff Rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff Rocks.
Yeah.
beautiful ladies of Centerfold with half-off drink specials until 6 p.m. Centerfold Lounge opens Monday through Saturday at 2 p.m. and Sundays at 6 p.m. Call 313-892-7333 for details or to book your holiday party. Indulge in your sexiest holiday fantasies and don't miss Centerfold's Christmas party every Monday and Tuesday.
The center of attraction.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and indeed, welcome back. We haven't really settled on a subject yet. I mean, I was raving about the fact that we're not too secure, are we, from terrorism. I don't know that you can completely stop it anyway. And I did say it was hyped that we have probably only several hundred people in the world that have, well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to count them. But one of the things that has to happen, they have to get here, right? Or they have to be here. So there's probably, as we've seen in Iraq, can you imagine if those folks were here? You know, the suicide bombers were here. I mean, they got them in Israel, too. I mean, in Palestine, that crossover into Israel to do that. So right now, and I mean, knock on plastic, that doesn't occur here. So there is a problem, but it can't be met with traditional warfare. I mean, we don't have a war on terrorism. That's hyperbole. That's an exaggerated language to kind of gin it up. So it'll take on a, I don't know what you can really call it, take it on a something that's larger than it actually is. And you can say, and I mean, it keeps coming back. What do you mean larger than it? I mean, remember September 11th? Well, yeah, they got damn lucky. They were lucky that Bushco did not pay any attention to all the warning signs. Right? They were lucky that they could get through airport security. They were lucky that they didn't, that the planes didn't get shot down. I know some of you think it was more than luck. And they were lucky that the buildings collapsed. And I know you think, many of you think that wasn't luck either. So, but it doesn't take a $500 million war budget, $500 million a year war budget to combat this. This is what justifies a permanent war economy. This is what we have done since the first quarter of 1942 when we were attacked. And we said, we better start producing a lot of war material. This Detroit became the arsenal of democracy and all that. But our priorities are way out of whack, and certainly the incompetents that are running things currently are, they're just not adequate for the job. They're not adequate for our security. They're not adequate for our economic security. Here's Jeff in Detroit. Jeff, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing great. Thanks for joining me.
No problem. I was just driving into Detroit from Chicago, and I caught part of your show.
Okay.
What you were saying earlier about the organization and stuff that's going on, first off, there's a great website called MoveOn.org that's doing a lot of activist-type things and getting things going for rallies and whatnot that are happening all over the world.
That's right.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said, that's right.
I live in Chicago. In Chicago, we've had a number of enormous rallies, a couple of which I've attended. You know, and it makes you wonder with that many people. I remember on one day in particular, they were having rallies in Chicago, New York, London. You know, this was happening all over the world. It was the largest turnout in our history of, you know, a group of people that were all making a statement against one thing and one person. You know, it was the largest event that had ever taken place like that. And you got to wonder where all these people were when the elections were happening and when he was getting voted in a second time.
Well, my opinion is he stole a second election, essentially. Stole the first one in Florida, the second one in Ohio. And, yeah, you're talking about February 15, 2003. I was in New York when there was probably a million people in the street saying no to Bush's war. I mean, that's what I always wonder about. I mean, we all knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. Imagine that in a city, a million people turning out. And I can't believe that people coming into Manhattan from out of town, like myself, could have represented any more than, say, 25 to 50,000, if that. And so it was like a million New Yorkers, people from the immediate area. I'm sure there were Jersey and Connecticut and what have you. And a million of us, just in that one city, knew there was no threat from Saddam Hussein, knew there was no connection to Al-Qaeda. And but somehow the New York Times didn't know that, and the Washington Post didn't know that, and the Detroit News and the Chicago Tribune and all of that. Except they really did know that.
Of course. Of course, they really know. But it's what can and cannot get away with saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you talk about the no weapons of mass destruction thing, and if you look, you know, it's always, you always hear it in movies and things, you follow the money trail, and you start looking at the money trail for what's really going on, and there's a number of people that believe that our occupation of Iraq has more to do with securing that pipeline out to the sea than it does with taking Saddam Hussein out of power or with trying to fight this war on terror.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, one of our buddies and allies gone bad, like Manuel Noriega in Panama. But
sure.
I heard he's up for parole. I mean, maybe, you know, Bush has a lot. You know, I'm going to cut you loose, Jeff, because your connection's really, really noisy. But thanks for joining us, and welcome to the Detroit from Chicago. Manuel Noriega, who was an erstwhile Bush 1 ally, and suddenly they found out horrors. This man is... what was he? He was indicted for selling drugs. So they had a little raid, a little bust in Panama City, and you know, 700 to 4,000 civilians were killed in the attack. I mean, you imagine that there's like a they're like a crack house raid in Detroit, and the Detroit police raid it, and they wind up killing like 200 people. I mean, think about the scandal that is, but that's what happened in Panama. I'm even willing to lowball the number, although I've seen enough substantial evidence to think that thousands of civilians were killed by the U.S. invasion. And but 700 is just amazing. So Noriega, once our ally, again, when he's not useful anymore, or useful in a different capacity, useful as enemy to justify... you know, this military excursion. A lot of ways for Daddy Bush, that was just sort of showing the flag. That's what he wanted to show, he could do it. Well, let me do this. Tell you that first there's open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. That's rare. So I would grab them if you can. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to Matt and Ypsilanti. Hey, Matt, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, Peter?
Going great, thanks.
I'd really like to talk with you about the topic you're on right now, but a man called in. He was talking about that bridge in Dearborn.
Yeah.
And I just want to kind of clarify what that is. It's Kwame's kind of deal for the city to make the city look good, and really it's an engineering-like masterpiece. They actually built it and took it down. And then built it again and engineered everything.
And where, I mean, it's right at where there's all that construction's been at Telegraph and I-94.
Yeah.
So what was he talking about that it was, he doesn't like the color that's blue?
I don't think he likes the way it looks. It's like a semicircle.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a personal taste thing. Some people like it, some people don't. It's an engineering masterpiece. Mm-hmm. The deal is it's free spanning.
Yeah.
And... there's no underneath support, so you could, like, span a river, you know, theoretically.
Well, what does Kwame have to do with it? He's the mayor of Detroit, isn't he?
Well, yeah, he's the mayor of Detroit, but he had to, you know, approve it.
Nah.
I don't know.
No,
kind of the stuff I heard floating around.
Yeah, I don't think he had anything to do with it. I mean, he couldn't have had anything to do with it, actually.
Yeah, I guess it's not his city.
Yeah. Well, all right. Thanks for the clarification. I appreciate that. Let's see. I'm sure that Sean is not in a city called Picking, or are you?
Beg your pardon?
Is this... tell me your name and where you're calling from. You're on the air.
Sean from Pinckney.
Oh, Pinckney. All right. We didn't have it up here too well. Go ahead, Sean. You're on the air.
You know, I just don't know why... Dick Cheney isn't getting a little more attention on this whole Iraq problem.
Yeah, well, he was one of the big liars, wasn't he?
Well, he's a big winner.
How do you think?
Well, all of his associates from Halliburton, I'm sure, are pushing dollars upon dollars into his pockets, literally, both for campaign finance and other bonuses, gifts, and whatnot.
Well, he still gets, I don't know if he's getting anything. I mean, of course, all those companies donate to the Republican Party, but also he still gets money yearly from Halliburton, where he was, what was he, president? Yeah, his president.
CEO.
Yeah, yeah, he was a CEO. But, you know, that's interesting. I've often made this point that what most rich people, when they mortally screw up, very little happens to them. Sometimes, you know, like we always hear, 1929, Black Friday, and the whole market crash, and you had all these stockbrokers jumping out of windows. Well, maybe some of the people that jumped had a lot of money, but you know what? All during the Depression, through the 1930s, late 20s, 1930s, rich people still drove enormous cars, had lavish parties, had estates and islands and everything like that. Because the deal is, it's like here in Detroit with Delphi. The Delphi people that screwed up, the General Motors people that screwed up, they're not going to have to pay the cost. They don't have to pay the freight. It's going to be the average hardworking man and woman. And it's the same thing with Bush and Cheney. Every time they made a screw up in business, and they made tons of them, they walked away with jillions of dollars, or at least, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Remember, Bush traded Sammy Sosa.
Yeah, you know, they always make out. That's always going to be a fact. There's no way around it.
Well, I would hate to think that's the case, that it's going to be on like on and on forever.
Well, it's a law of capitalism.
Well, yeah. Well, it's called the two aspects. One is the golden rule, those that have the gold rule, correct? And mm-hmm. And then it's the melting pot. What is it? Those on the bottom get burned and the scum rises to the top.
Right. The people who work hardest make less.
Yeah, there's something wrong there.
I mean, well, it's capitalism.
Yeah. I mean, because our labor is bought and sold as a commodity. And so if there's a lot of people willing to clean toilets, they get paid poorly. Whereas I would say that anybody that's got to clean up other people's crap ought to be getting like CEO pay. I mean, like for real.
Si, senor.
Okay, whatever that means. Hasta la vista, baby. All right. I'm not getting any indication of where to go next, so I'll just go where the hell I want. All right, it's Tom. Tom's driving a truck. Hi, Tom. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, my name is Tom. Tom, I'm from Joplin, Missouri. Hey, you was talking about 700 to 4,000 people getting killed with Noriega.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you liberals, you guys just throw numbers out there. Is it 700 or is it 4,000?
Well, here's what I was saying, Tom. I have the official U.S. government estimation is 700. Besides, I'm not a liberal. I'm much more radical than that. But in any event, that the official government toll is 700. But I have seen other stuff that is as high as 4,000. And what the hell is a working man doing not being at least a liberal? Are you out of your mind?
No, I ain't out of my mind.
Well, you must be if you're backing some right-wing rich party that wants to fleece the little guy, for Christ's sakes. What the hell are you paying in gasoline prices, and who do you think's making out on that?
You know, this country, we became great because of our capitalist ideas, you know.
Well, that's another question. I'm just asking you, how is you as a truck driver who's being screwed by the corporations that are the mainstay of Bush Incorporated would support a politician like that?
You know, I feel like I love my president. You know, he had the balls to stand up whenever they come in and attack my country.
Well, what do you mean he had the balls to stand up? What did he do? I remember they started flying him all around the country. Then they, rather than coming back to Washington like a real leader should, and then finally, when the smoke is cleared, he has the balls to go down there and make a speech. I'm asking you, as a working man, as a hard-working truck driver who's getting screwed by ExxonMobil, who gives millions of dollars to the to Bush, what goes through your mind that you could love this guy? He's taking you to the cleaners, pal.
How's he taking me to the cleaners? He gave me a tax.
Oh, God, that tax break didn't. He gave tax breaks to the ultra rich, and in the meantime, he took everything back because you have to pay a little bit more when you go fill your truck up with diesel. How much does it cost you to fill up your tank?
Oh, it cost around $600.
Oh, my God. And that's coming out of somebody's pocket and going into somebody's pocket. And it's a rich guy that would never invite you in a million years over to his house. He probably, his gated community, they'd say, look, oh, Tom, he's only a truck driver. I don't want him near my house. Tom, think about it all. Please, you're not doing yourself a favor. Thanks for joining us. Keep on driving, bro. Well, I mean, what will it? I mean, that's the third of the population, I guess. Willfully ignorant, I would say. All right, Adam and Romulus. Adam, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I called to talk about Iraq, but I wanted to make just a really quick comment about the suspension bridge over Telegraph.
Yeah, I got to go out and look at it.
Yeah, Kwame convinced Wayne County that before the Super Bowl, we needed something along the 94 corridor that would be eye-catching, that the tourists that are going to come in to see the Super Bowl are going to say, oh, well, Detroit and the area isn't a total piece of crap or whatnot. Of course, let's not forget that 94 is just a completely terrible stretch of highway. I mean, I live right off 94. You know, I don't think that throwing up some silly little ornament is going to do any good. But
hey, Adam, we've got the giant tire.
Yeah.
But wait. I mean, you really think that Kwame Kilpatrick has enough clout that he could actually convince, who was it, the Wayne County Board of Supervisors, that they should spend a jillion dollars on a bridge that's not necessary?
Well,
I mean, maybe.
I think so, because I saw him on television talking about it about a year ago before the project went through. He probably wasn't the sole supporter, but he was one of the supporters of that. But
okay.
The thing I wanted to say about Iraq, though, is, okay, we talk about the Downing Street letter, but the truth is that I forget the name of the group, but it's something like the Coalition for a New America. It's a conservative think tank that Bush and Cheney were part of. They were planning an attack on Iraq before Bush even took office. You know, nobody's talking about this. It has nothing to do with terrorism. It has nothing to do with 9/11. It has nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction or Saddam. It has to do with the fact that we want an OPEC nation that's going to be eventually friendly to us. We want to have control over things that are going on there for a while. We want companies like Halliburton to make tons of money selling, you know, serving spoiled food to our troops and, you know, all the other rebuilding of Iraq, like opening a bunch of schools that there are no teachers to teach in anyway. I mean, it's all completely foolish. We don't hear anything about what's really going on in the news media, and they can say whatever they want, and people just buy it. I mean,
well, wait. I disagree with you completely, Adam. People aren't buying it anymore. You're talking about the Project for a New American Century,
right?
And Cheney was part of it. Bush was not. Bush isn't smart enough to be part of that. I mean, these were so-called thinkers. These were the conservatives, the people that we're now calling self-servatives rather than conservatives. Got to hit this before midnight to get these commercials in. Adam, thanks for joining me at 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Every successful career has a beginning. Have you started yours yet? Turbocharge your opportunities by calling ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-903-1919. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. If you have an interest in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design, they teach skills that many employers look for. Most programs provide a hands-on education and can help you build your knowledge base and technical skills. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Develop technical skills at an ITT Tech and discover a whole new world of opportunity. Call now for a brochure at 1-800-903-1919. That's ITT Tech, 1-800-903-1919. 1-800-903-1919. 101 WRIF and Media Play present the Free U College Giveaway. Use your MasterCard or complete an entry form at Media Play, and you could win a one-time payment of $150,000 towards college tuition. No purchase necessary. Ends December 31st, 2005. Open to U.S. residents 18 or older. For rules and alternate entry details, visit your Media Play store today or log on MediaPlay.com or WRIF.com. Media Play with locations in Livonia, Utica, Taylor, Clinton Township, and Ann Arbor.
This is WRIM.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
Sparkle and brilliance, handcrafted by the master diamond artisans at Leo Schachter. JBR offers the Leo in rings, pendants, and earrings from $599.99 to $7,000.
JBR.
Doing business the right way since 1929.
JB Robinson.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. I'm kind of hesitating because I was going to tell you what's going to be on at 1 a.m. Eastern time. And I can't remember. Let me see. I did interviews. All right. Well, anyways, a couple of interesting interviews. What the hell they are, I can't remember. But if they weren't interviews, I wouldn't put them on the air. Here's an interesting letter, email message from John. He's listening and wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hey, Peter, love your show. I got to tell you, though, I'm sick of hearing about Bushco. It's just so depressing. I know you're a man who prefers solutions, so I might suggest two topics. Well, before I read the rest of it, let me say that I agree. I feel the same way. I always have, like, if you could only see my console here at WRIF, it's about, I brought in like 3 inches high, of course, two of them were newspapers, of stories of everything under the sun, about executions, about our economy, talk about depressing, all right? So the other thing is, you're the listener, and Jay Hudson, our phone screener and producer, also the host of WRIF's Motor City Riffs, he just essentially says, you want to talk to Peter? I don't even think he says, what do you want to talk about? Just, or maybe he does. But anyways, you can talk about anything you want. So if you want to talk about the bridge over I-94 at Telegraph, I know that's not really exciting to those of you that are listening around the world and around the country, but hey, you know, we're a Detroit station, so bring it up. Anyways, here's what he says we should talk about. The comparison of the Big Three and Toyota business practices. Yeah, I mean, Toyota taken off. Going to leave General Motors in the dust, or the living sciences, according to Jenny Grandholm, is the future of Michigan's economy. John, I don't think that's going to make real exciting radio, but if you'd like to call in, 313-298-WRIF, and let's see, let's go out to Kalamazoo and say hello to Barry. Barry Heights, Peter Werbe, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good, thank you.
First time caller, long time listener.
Oh, welcome. What do you listen? You listen on the internet, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I lived in Windsor for a while. I'm actually Canadian, living here in Kalamazoo. What are your thoughts, just on a different note here, of the possibility of a kind of a Bush-loving conservative party governing in Canada?
Well, I don't know. I don't think that the conservatives, what we're calling now the self-servatives, are going to be able to put it together. I mean, the Parti Québécois blocks with the Liberals, right?
No. Well, just recently joined up. Against,
yeah, I know. Yeah. But, I mean, normally, there's usually the Liberals and the Parti Québécois and the Labour Party, the New Democratic Party.
Yes.
Yeah. So I don't think the Conservatives are going to be able to do much, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. I haven't really looked at it. I mean, Americans are so dumb, let alone even those of us who are a few miles away from our, well, here, of course, our neighbors to the south. Windsor is to the south of Detroit,
yeah,
isn't it? But in any event, I remember Reagan one time. I mean, he was, you know, kind of a dim bulb even when he was the president. He referred to your prime minister, Mulroney, as Muldoon.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's how bad it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay.
All right, that's it?
Your thoughts.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't think that's going to happen in Canada. All right, let's see here. We'll take our next caller. It's going to be Jim from Westland. Jim, hi, it's Peter Werbe.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
What I keep on hearing from you is the problem of America, pretty much Bush, mm-hmm, conservatives.
What's my solution?
Well, basically, there's three steps, okay? Each one getting more and more severe. First, we need an opposition party, okay?
Mm-hmm.
One of the people, by the people, basically what the American ideal should be, okay? One that isn't really corrupt at its core, that will actually stand up for us.
You don't want to have any longer a by the rich, for the rich, and of the rich?
No.
You must be some kind of commie, Jim.
Well, you're going to like the second step.
Go ahead.
We need a revolution to basically abort this corrupt political system, to rewrite it to where it actually works for us.
We may almost be at the point where we have to start over again.
And the last step, I don't want to go here, but it's most dangerous of all. We need American Civil War, the second American Civil War.
Well, I mean, like by force of arms?
By force of arms.
Well, Jim.
We need to.
That's an awful idea.
We can't take it anymore.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I don't even know what to say. I'm sort of flabbergasted at it. I mean, there's certainly the mechanism within our foundation document, the Constitution, allows for any kind of change possible. The real problem is, I mean, people only go for revolutions and civil war. I mean, look at how catastrophic that was. And we still haven't, 140 years later, we still haven't completely healed it all. But people want revolution only at last resort. And we haven't even gone through the available mechanisms. Sure, the press is controlled by big interests. All the institutions are either not serving their purposes or, as you say, out and out corrupt. I mean, think about this. I mean, a country that allows its political representatives to be bought and sold by lobbyists. It used to be in many states, it was illegal to try to influence legislation. I mean, everything that the lobbyists are doing now, they're pouring millions of dollars into contributions to the parties and all, that was illegal 100 years ago in most of the states. So what is really the core problem is our passivity, that we, and it's hard. I mean, you might be sitting there in Westland and some of the other people that have talked before are completely isolated, and they think, How would I do any of it? How would I even be politically active? How would, let alone a revolution? Or how would I challenge the entrenched power of these corrupt bureaucracies that rule us? And the answer, and that's why I say I don't know, because we have not created the forms yet. We have not created this kind of spontaneous forms that occurred all throughout American history that changed American history. Remember, right at the beginning, it was the committees of correspondence. A few years before that, there was nothing. There was just a bunch of colonists that were saying, this sucks. I mean, what the hell is with our king? And people would go, yeah, they didn't have talk shows. So they would do really odd things like go to cafes and hang out and talk and stuff like that, person to person. They didn't even have an internet, so they couldn't even email one another. They actually had to talk to one another, which is obviously a key, I think, to it all. A lot to be learned and a lot good way to communicate by the internet, but eventually we've got to start creating face-to-face forms. So they had no idea. They had, and they didn't, we say the revolution was, they just signed a piece of paper and said, we're out of here. We didn't do anything. We just don't recognize your authority anymore, Mr. King. And then the king, he said, wait a minute, man, this is my territory. Which is just insane, those kind of relationships. But whatever. So I'm just sort of rambling. The point is our passivity. And I'm not saying you're a, I don't mean you, Jim. I'm not trying to say anyone listening or me or anybody that you're a bad person because you're passive. Because if I'll bet you 99% of you, if you said I want to be active tomorrow, then all of a sudden you'd say, what the hell do I do? Where do I go? Yeah, where do I look up in the phone book? Where do I find on the internet? Well, it's a little easier. You can find stuff on the internet, and there's probably 100 things. I mentioned my website calendar. Somebody else mentioned moveon.org. You can, if you're listening nationally, there's unitedforpeace.org. Again, most go to any left website, and it's all there. But all right, so let's try for like the opposition party first, and maybe not go the civil war route. It didn't work well last time. All right, Jim, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here's David in Commerce. David, hi, it's Peter Werby. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good, thanks.
Good. Yeah, I was just going to comment that that truck driver, I think he must represent the 37%. Approval rating that Bush is currently receiving.
Yeah, well, you always wonder, who are these people that still think he's doing a good job?
Well, it really puzzles me, the ignorance of some people, and just like you said, I guess the passivity of some people. I mean, I remember when they were beating the war drums back in 2001, 2002, and I didn't believe it for a second. And I wish people would just go out and pick up some of the good books that are out there. Seymour Hersh wrote one called Chain of Command, and of course Craig Unger wrote one called House of Bush, House of Saud. You've probably heard of both of those.
That's a great Bush. That's a favorite of Drew and Mike, our morning show. here. I mean, it's kind of odd. I mean, they often roll over for Bush, but they interviewed him twice, and I interviewed him once.
No kidding. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering where the media was back when they were beating the war drums, once again, as I was speaking of. And why didn't people question this, or why didn't more of the media question when they made these claims of weapons of mass destruction? And now, we're almost 3 years later since we've been in. I mean, it's just terrible.
Well, it's kind of interesting. You read the New York Times, that every once in a while they'll say, this page was wrong, and they start with the editorial page. But, I mean, I don't know what to say. I don't know what the internal mechanism of denial must have been for these newspapers or these media outlets that could have or should have known on the face of it that everything that Bush was saying about Iraq was a lie. I mean, I knew that, and all I did, I was getting stuff since, for instance, from lots of places. But if you go to, during that period, if you went to BuzzFlash.com, they had all the mainstream newspaper articles that refuted these claims. So they were out there. And one of the things, they didn't do their job. I mean, I've said this before, that when what they should have had was Bush said blah, 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 and you know, we're going to be destroyed by Iraq and their atomic weapons. And then, since there were the people that knew this was bunk and opposed the oncoming war and knew it was solely for immediate political gains and for long-term oil reasons, they should have, in the second paragraph, said, opposition leaders said, this is all bunk. But so they're really complicit. It was, I mean, we had Pravda and Izvestia. If people remember those old Soviet era papers, you know, that's what it was, just essentially reflecting the party line. That's all. And then we'd have a big demonstration, like somebody said back earlier on February 15th, 2003. Tens of millions of people all around the world, million people in New York, 100,000 in L.A. and San Francisco and people like that. And it's my favorite thing to do. So you have these guys in suits on television with flags in their lapel and flags behind them, very studied setting. And they're saying, yes, well, we have information that Saddam Hussein has atomic weapons. And then our side is represented by people going, Bush did a letter, Bush did a letter. And you go, man, those people are weird. You know, that's with the passive TV viewer. So it's the opposition was never represented in a material manner or in a manner that justified comparing the claims of Bush to the counterclaims of the people that said, no, this is all bunk, you're lying.
Well, I'm in my mid-30s, so maybe you can address this. I've heard back in the 60s when LBJ was president and when he was pushing the Vietnam War and everything, that Walter Cronkite came out and said that this is an unwinnable war. And do you remember that, or have you heard of that?
No, but it wouldn't surprise me. Hopefully he did that.
Well, my point is, why isn't somebody in the media doing that today? Why isn't one of these anchors?
Oh, no, they're doing, well, I don't know, one of the anchors, but certainly the major publications are USA Today, New York Times, Washington Post. But here, it's interesting that you bring that up. Here, let me just, this is in the December 1st New York Times. Vietnam War intelligence deliberately skewed. Well, what a surprise. National Security Agency has released hundreds of pages of long secret documents on the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin incident, which played a critical role in significantly expanding the American commitment to the Vietnam War.
I've seen that.
Okay. The evidence passed on to policymakers and the public to falsely suggest that North Vietnamese ships had attacked American destroyers on August 4th, 1964. So the entire Vietnam War was based on a lie. And we're talking about a couple thousand Americans, pretty awful, dead, 100,000 Iraqis dead, civilians, pretty awful. We're talking there, 3 million Indochinese, 60,000 Americans, this mountain of corpses because of a lie. And, you know, Bush says, just like Johnson and then Nixon, we're not leaving till victory. These people, how many times are we going to get fooled?
Yeah, it's really unbelievable. You go back to the old saying that those who don't learn from history are condemned.
Oh, man, I am sorry. I had my apologies to you. I had my, the Santayana quote, those who are who don't learn from history are condemned to relive it. Again, my apologies. I hit the button prematurely. All right, I'm going to just, if you're on the line, you want to talk about anything else we've been talking about, you don't have to change your mind. But I did want to bring something up that I've had here for a while. And did you see the announcement that the Motor City Casino is going to become the second Detroit gambling house to break ground on a permanent facility? I don't know. I didn't see where it was going to be. Remember they were going to do it down by the riverfront, and they closed all those businesses down in, what was the name of that district, the warehouse district? They had a name for it. Owner Marion Illich, there's a famous name if you're familiar with the Detroit Red Wings or Little Caesars Pizza, said the $275 million casino, hotel, and conference center would take anywhere from 18 months to 2 years. The 17-story, 400-room hotel tower will rise on a surface parking lot. Oh, here it is, adjacent to the casino's parking deck, and should be up in late 2007. So they're not, it's going to be right where they are now, down off of the Lodge and Grand River. Well, there it is. The casino's, hello, read the whole thing through, Pete, is located near the Lodge in Grand River Boulevard. You know what this says? I mean, I've shot craps on the street. I shouldn't even announce this. Pitched pennies, shot craps, played all-night poker games. And so I don't have any problem with gambling. I mean, it can get out of hand. And I mean, it didn't with me or any of my friends. But I don't have anything against gambling. But this institutionalized, massive gambling presence in an already poor city essentially just loots it. I mean, I know people that have won thousands of dollars there. But overall, of course, the people of the city of Detroit and the environs lose tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. And a lot of poor people go there, a lot of working class people. So it's actually, what do you call this? This is a progressive tax. In other words, the more you earn, supposedly, the more you should pay. But then there's like flat tax, non-progressive. I can't remember what the hell they call that. Anyway, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. But this is essentially another tax. I mean, one of the reasons that the poor and the working class gamble. I mean, some people just like to gamble and all that. But, I mean, most of this stuff is just pulling a, you don't even pull a lever anymore. You just press a button for the slots. And it's, you know, it's a dream. It's like the lottery. It's another thing that just screws poor and working people as well. And we're always told we're going to have these casinos, we're going to have this lottery, and it's going to create great schools in the city of Detroit. It's going to have this this revenue influx. Well, the city of Detroit is broke. There's thousands of homeless people. And, there we go. Oh, I heard this first on the radio, on a news show. And there was, too, that Motor City Casino starts construction of permanent building, $275 million. Gives you an idea how much they've sucked out of us. And then the next item, and it must have been put there purposely, problem gamblers' numbers rise. The number of problem gamblers on the rise. Well, hello. What do you think? So they know. The gamblers, the gambling houses, as they called it in this article from the Detroit Free Press, they know that a certain percentage of their income is going to come from compulsive gamblers. I suppose that's not unusual. I mean, dope dealers know that a good portion of their proceeds come from addicts that can't control their consumption. Even liquor stores know that a portion of it. In fact, there's some figure, if somebody has it there, tell me. Like something like 20% of drinkers drink like 70% of booze, or, you know, something like that. So they know by establishing these gambling houses that you're going to have, they don't have it in this. This is upbeat article. That I forgot what problem gamblers are. Could even be under 10%, but say it's just for, it's 10%. So these are the people that ruin their lives, screw up their families. But the other thing is, besides all of this money, these hundreds of millions of dollars being sucked out of the community for people through people's losses, also then they create enormous social problems that we, the general public, even if we don't gamble, have to pay as well. Because when these people totally screw up, there's a safety net of some sort. So, your opinions on that as well. 313-298-WRIF. The show is Night Call. I'm Peter Werby. And here's Joe in Ypsilanti. Joe, hi. A lot of people calling from Ypsilanti tonight. Welcome.
I knew raising my hand would help.
There you go. Thank you for joining us.
No problem. Pete, you old buzzkill. Damn. I want to talk about the bridge.
Okay.
It's just as a side note. I have something else I really wanted to talk about, but just a comment on that. Back in the summer, I haven't been by there in a while myself, but back in the summer, I had some friends up to go to a concert down off of Woodward, and the construction, the way that they had, I mean, I swear they had 94 routed through, like, mall parking lot or something. It was just so embarrassing to have these friends from out of town going through this. I don't care what the hell they're building. That was awful.
Wait. What, you have not lived till you were in Boston and saw what was called the Big Dig, this huge tunnel that made anything else by comparison look like a minor detour. But go ahead. What's your other topic, Joe?
Well, the other thing is I'm kind of putting two and two together here.
That's going to get you in trouble, but go ahead.
Sometimes, I get the impression Peter doesn't like to voice his opinion on things unless he's asked. So I want to ask you about something that you mentioned earlier. You know, you said there's a lot of you, referring to us listeners, who think that they had more than just luck with the buildings falling down. And I've never, you know, I'm a longtime listener. I love your show. What is your opinion as far as how the towers fell?
Well, I have no idea. And I mean, I just watched some videos tonight, and there's this prof, where is it, out in Oregon or something?
Yep.
Yeah, and he puts forth as a hypothesis, he doesn't even say that it's a conclusion, he says it's a hypothesis that Building 7, that there's no reason why it should have fallen, that he timed it, that it exceeds the speed of gravity, and everything points to a internal controlled explosion, so that when the planes hit, there was also then these detonations inside, and there's this man who actually saved all these people. He says he heard explosions and what have you. The only thing that doesn't make any sense to me is who in the hell would do it and why.
Right. Well, that opens up a whole other.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
animal.
the real either disturbing charge or wacko paranoia, or if you will, I mean, those are two opposite poles, would be like the government did it because they wanted to create a crisis, they wanted to be able to rule unchallenged and what have you. But these kind of things are just too dangerous. And huge conspiracies, and that would have to be pretty elaborate, they have the capacity to quickly fall apart. And I would suggest that simply the act of what we witnessed of the plane simply hitting the buildings and another one hitting the Pentagon would have created the same sort of response, even if they hadn't have fallen. I mean, the imagery certainly was one of the most probably the most shocking thing most of us have ever seen, unless they've been in war zones.
Well, of course, I mean, it's shock and awe. Those are two different topics, really, as far as the planes hitting and then them falling. As far as the planes hitting, I mean, Hani Hanjour, who supposedly was piloting the plane that performed that spectacular feat of aeronautics to hit the Pentagon, you know, that guy couldn't fly for nothing. That guy couldn't fly a single-engine plane. But as far as the towers falling themselves, you did refer just now to the free fall thing. And what it is if I have my numbers straight, we'll use Building 7, although I'd rather use one of the towers because it's a little more, it makes a little more of a point. But both of them, basically, if you drop something off of the roof of Trade Center 7, it would take 6 seconds approximately for that object to hit the ground. And it took, depending on how you time it, about 6.5 seconds for the building to completely collapse. That would mean that every floor, including the trade centers, all of them, pancaking my tuchus, that all of them just gave way, just like, oh, I'm broken. You know, it was just a complete free fall. There's no way.
Yeah.
It doesn't time out.
Well, I have no way to dispute that. Here's my feeling. That that people that really are deeply moved by this question ought to keep pushing it forward to see if there's anything there. I mean, as you may know, just a few weeks ago, I had two people, or, well, actually, I had, what did I have? Both of them on, the authors of a book about the Kennedy assassination. That happened 42 years ago. So these questions don't necessarily go away, nor should they deserve to. But I think the most telling thing about it is that there are hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Americans, and we saw, I don't know what I did with that, yeah, here. Half of New Yorkers believe U.S. leaders consciously failed to act on September 11th, including 66% of people that live in New York City. So there, when you talk about catastrophe, there's also a catastrophic lack of confidence on one, well, I don't even know, that's quite an understatement, that people no longer believe official statements, and it's weird. We, on one hand, almost as a nation, with the exception of a few of us, believed what Bush said about Iraq. But then all of a sudden, around 9/11, people are saying, well, I don't think I go for the official explanation. And I think that's important. And I think it's important. But here, another thing. These things become labyrinthic. You can get into them and never get out. So people often wind up chained to their computer and emails and websites about this. So I don't know how you make the balance. I always, like, someone asked me, who did I think killed Kennedy? Everybody was saying the CIA and the mob and all that. I said, I don't know. I have no idea who did it. A lot of the stories I've heard, including the latest one, Ultimate Sacrifice by Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman, seem to make a hell of a lot of sense, but it's hard to say. I know the official explanation makes no sense whatsoever, that Lee Harvey Oswald was not the lone assassin. Where to go from there? Don't know. But I think the Kennedy assassination and the flawed official explanation and investigation is in many ways what started the questioning of authority. In that manner, it's good. All right, got to take a break. Thank you.
This is WRIF.com.
The lowdown on the hottest concerts in town are only a click away with a singular wireless concert connection. Log on to the concerts page right now at WRIF.com to find out where your favorite bands are appearing live in concert across the Motor City. Keep it right here on the Riff for your chance to text in to win tickets, backstage passes, autographed rock merchandise, and more exclusively on your singular wireless phone. The singular wireless concert connection from Singular Wireless, raising the bar at 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks. Rock, rock, rock.
101 WRIF and Media Play present the Free U College Giveaway. Use your MasterCard or complete an entry form at Media Play, and you could win a one-time payment of $150,000 towards college tuition. No purchase necessary. Ends December 31st, 2005. Open to U.S. residents 18 or older. For rules and alternate entry details, visit your Media Play store today or log on MediaPlay.com or WRIF.com. Media Play, with locations in Livonia, Utica, Taylor, Clinton Township, and Ann Arbor.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF. WRIF
reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. We'll run it right up till 1 a.m. Eastern time, then do our, we'll have a few commercials, but then the interviews that I did earlier in the week. Oh, yeah, talking about 911, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. Here's what you should do if you're interested. Go to 911busters.com, like B-U-S-T-E-R-S.com, 911busters.com. You go to my website, peterwerby.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E, B as in boy, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. Go down the left-hand column. There's an old Daily News, New York Daily News front page. It said Bush New. Click on that, and you'll get all these resources. So see, guys, I'm not part of the conspiracy. That's sort of the suggestion, you know, that if I'm trying to trying to focus away from this or deny that there was controlled explosions. It must be part of the conspiracy. Oh, wait a minute. There was another one here, too. Let's see. Ron, who's listening in Fort Wayne, Indiana, says, let me get you this quickly. Serendipity. Oh, my God. There's too much here. .li/WTC.htm. I don't know. There's too much there for me. But we're also talking about websites where people can look to find out what's happening. WorldCan'tWait.org. WorldCan'tWait.org. No apostrophe in there. Thanks to Dean for sending that in there. And pardon me. Let's go back to our phones here. And we'll pick up on Rob. Rob's listening in Clinton Township. Hey, Rob, it's Peter Werby. Welcome to WRIF.
How you doing, Peter?
Good, thanks.
I was calling about actually an article I read. I'm reading on Reuters.
Reuters,
about,
yeah.
About Bush seeking to compromise on CIA torture ban.
Yeah, he just wants to torture people a little, or just a few people.
Well, it says on here that Dick Cheney led a White House bid to exempt the CIA from the ban.
Yeah, well, Bush said
we can only torture when we want to.
Yeah, well, the deal was Bush said we do not torture, and of course everybody in the world knows that there's these pretty ghastly tortures going on, and a lot of people, I think, Rob, probably would would say, well, gee, if we got to torture these guys so they don't bomb us again like they did on 9-1-1, fine. Except is where, you know, hundreds of people are being picked up, being subjected to these beastly tortures, particularly when we render them onto other countries. We violate U.S. law. We violate international law. And interestingly, the Republican John McCain, senator who introduced the bill that would prohibit the CIA and everybody else from torturing prisoners, had the full backing of the military, because if you start torturing your prisoners, they can start torturing our prisoners.
And we love to use that as an excuse to do things too to other countries.
Yeah. Well, the other problem with it is, you know, people say, well, what if you could torture Mohammed Atta and get the immediate information out of him that he was going to hit the trade towers? I got to tell you, if there was every prohibition in the world and the full commitment of the U.S. government to never using the kind of harsh tortures we associate with torture states like we are now, and somebody had some information and we knew there were that a bomb was ticking and somebody was in our hands, people would skirt the law for that one moment. But to allow the torture of individuals as a matter of policy and to do it widespread, that's what torture states do. Whenever you come in contact with them, harsh punishment is meted out exactly. So, and plus you have people, American citizens, that's their job. I mean, they call them interrogators, but we're hiring people who torture people. We have American citizens, our neighbors, who when you bring the person out of the cell, the first thing they do, they get smashed in the face or clubbed to the ground or kicked in the balls or something like that. And they're not even asked the question. You just want to know that you're dealing with people who will do anything to them. I mean, that's one of the ways that you start. Of course, what happens is you get people who are tortured, who are waterboarded, you know, water torture essentially to them, that start telling you anything. And that's one of the sources that Bush and others got information about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. I mean, Lenny Bruce, the old comedian, used to say, yeah, you bring out the hot lead enema, I'm going to tell you anything. Yeah, I'll confess. Sure, I did it. On the other hand, we know in our own where torture in the sense of beatings is kind of commonplace, hopefully less so, but certainly was for generations and generations when the poor came in contact with American police, that they had the crap beat out of them and oftentimes had confessions beat out of them. And that was particularly so in Illinois, where the Republican governor, what did he do? He commuted I don't know how many sentences. After person, it was proved that they hadn't committed the crime they were on death row for. And essentially, I mean, why say beating? They were tortured by the Chicago police in particular, and they got out of them what they want. Because if someone is really doing something awful to you, you'll tell them anything. Final thing. And I'll let you respond, sorry, is that when you capture somebody, all right, and you either send them to some other torture state like Egypt or some place like that, or you have Americans do it to them, and you realize that either you get information from them or in most cases you don't, what do you do with them then? You've got these people that are these political liabilities. Because they're going to get out, just like the people have gotten out of Guantanamo and talked about the awful things that were done to them. And you, all of a sudden, you're saying, hey, I was tortured by Americans. These are the people that say they believe in the rule of law, but yet begin to hold people for years without trial. And the problem is, nobody cares about it if a murderer is having a confession tortured out of him, or a terrorist is getting it tortured out of him, or some guy we don't like who we think has done something is kept without a trial. But that violates exactly why the American Constitution was established, to make sure that stuff like that did not occur. Because for every guilty person that has that done to him, usually there's dozens and dozens more of innocent people, or even if they are, quote, guilty, it's not the executive branch's position to punish. That's not their job. All right, sorry. Go ahead, Rob. I was on a rave, wasn't I? You with me? He said, what the hell, man? You ran away with it. Sorry. Up on the St. Clair River, it's Rick in Marine City. How you doing, Rick? Welcome. You're on the air.
My name's Nick, actually, sir.
Let me see. Did he have Mick on there? No, says Rick. All right, go ahead, Mick.
I'm a college student at Wayne State, and I was wondering, what can I do to try and, like, battle against this whole, you know, out for us movement that's going on in American culture and society and government?
Well, there, I know, I mean, by now, most of the people I know aren't students, but are professors there. And they have meetings, forums, rallies, lectures. I mean, you start figuring out, you go to some of these and you think, well, maybe these people have got some good ideas, but I'm not sure I want to hang around them because this or that. Or, I mean, it's a matter of like finding something that makes sense to you. I mean, they got people on at Wayne State that do things are everything from Christian pacifist over to communist, probably, right? And you think, well, hey, I'm kind of a commie, I'll hang with them. Well, you're not, I'm kind of a Christian pacifist, or I'm a Christian, I'll see what they're doing. Well, I'm neither of those, so maybe I'll take a look at just what the, I forgot, I can't even think of the name of the group. But I know there's stuff happening at Wayne State University. If you check the South End newspaper, if you check some of the kiosks around that have leaflets up, you know, you can start hooking into that.
Okay. What I was going to say is that there is, like, one active political student party on campus, and it's the Student Republicans, and the only other campus political organization I know about is the communist one, and they don't really have any of the same views that I do, and I was wondering if there's any way I could get information about maybe starting a grassroots movement there.
Well, why don't you do this? You have email, obviously, right?
Yeah.
Email me at calltalkyes@yahoo. Calltalkyes@yahoo. I'll ask some of my professor friends. wait a minute. I got an argument here with my producer. Did you say your name was Nick or Mick?
Nick.
With an N or an M?
N.
Okay. He says, it says Nick. It says Nick. It sometimes it's hard to read. It's a little print. All right. Nick, give me a shout via email, and I'll see what I can turn up for you in the next couple of days. Am I right? Yeah, isn't there a ferry that goes to Marine City?
There's two ferries. There's one that goes from Canada to Marine City. There's one that goes from Wapu Island to Marine City, and there's one that goes from Harsons to Marine City.
Wow, yeah, sometimes from, what is it called, Sombra, Ontario to, yeah, and sometimes my wife and I take it when we go up to, like, the Bruce Peninsula in Canada or just up, you know, to the Pinery. You know where that is? You must.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And so, yeah, so and it's kind of cool taking this little auto ferry. What is it? It takes about 8 cars or something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. All right, Nick, give me a shout via email, anybody else, too, and I'll see if I can hook you up with somebody. But, yeah, a lot of times, I mean, there's a lot of people. Sometimes, like, for instance, I'll give lots of web addresses. Doesn't mean necessarily that I want to hang with them or that I want to get enmeshed directly in their deal. But even if I don't particularly agree with everything they're saying, if they have an interesting speaker or something like that, I'll check it out.
What did you say the email was?
Oh, calltalkyes@yahoo.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Nick. All right, thanks a lot. Thanks for joining me. Yeah, and sometimes it's worth doing that, you know, starting your own group. You go, start my own group? How the hell am I going to do that? Every group had to start somewhere, and I know a lot of us would just like to join. I mean, I don't want to go start my own group. All right, let's go to John in Pontiac. John, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air. Wait a minute. Go ahead. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I've got a couple of things I wanted to talk about tonight. One of which, I don't remember that guy's name. There was a couple of guys, actually, that were asking, basically, how could the mainstream media ignore, you know, what was going on over in Iraq and yada, yada, yada. And apparently a lot of Americans seem to have forgotten about the Patriot Act.
Okay.
I mean, Bush has had several reporters arrested, no charges filed. We have no idea how bad the torture has been against them, simply for trying to speak the truth, and they were American reporters. I'm kind of amazed you haven't been picked up yet.
Well, but, wait. I, you know, I, I, it, I think that people have fallen in line pretty well. I don't think, John, anybody's been arrested just for a few people have been, you know, fired. And when I was doing a nationally syndicated talk show, I lost a number of affiliates because they didn't like me calling Bush a liar. Now everybody calls him a liar.
Yeah, but there's a difference between calling him a liar, which is basically just giving your own opinion,
right,
and disseminating information, which is what our American reporters in Iraq had the opportunity to do.
Yeah.
And there's been cases that have, you know, now a couple of troops have come home and reported a couple of cases where they've, you know, they were sitting right there watching what was, you know, popping up on the screen as the reporters were filming it, and they were ordered, as soon as they saw a couple of things on the screen, you know, pick them up. We can't have that shown.
Hmm.
And, you know, I mean, that's...
Well, as long as I could go to a minimum security prison, I haven't played tennis in years and get some reading done and stuff like that. Well, I don't know, John. I mean, I think things, I think the media sucks in the main, didn't do its job, but I'm not sure. If you got direct information or direct sources or other people's do, send it to me. I'd appreciate it. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Now, what did I just see here? Jordan says, hi, I'm 14 and my dad works with this guy that is obsessed with the idea that Russia is behind all this 911 thing. And that he knows stuff that the CIA doesn't, and Russia's going to attack the U.S. in 10 years that will put us in a nuclear winter and kill us all and end up in the world ending. Well, I got to tell you, and I mean, this isn't so new, is that the fact that Bush dropped the opportunity to do great amount of disarmament, in fact, start drawing down the nuclear stockpiles of weaponry to nothing, makes this scenario not impossible. There are people talk about an axis. Now, what are they always talking about? Well, yeah, like Russia, China, and Iran, or just Russia and Iran. Plus, there are all these whacked out far right wingers, these fascists, that see the United States and Israel as the enemy of Europe that should be led by Russia. So the fact that there are that anybody has nuclear weapons, whether it's the U.S. or Britain or India or Pakistan or Israel, is extraordinarily dangerous. And what is unforgivable is the fact that Bush let this opportunity to do massive reduction of nuclear weapons go by. I mean, how can, like Sharon says, we can't let Iran have the Prime Minister of Israel. We can't let Iran have nuclear weapons. How can we let Israel have them? How can we let ourselves have them? That the United States, again, talk about making peace rather than creating the context always for war. And at some point, yeah, we're going to lose it. We're going to take either we're going to lose a war or we're going to take really huge losses. That is, if people started tossing nukes around, and rather than we're always preparing for war, whereas we could prepare for peace. And I'm not saying like give up or surrender. You say, all right, hey Russia, we've got, what do we got? I don't know, something like 10,000 nuclear weapons. Let's draw it down to 500 apiece, and we'll still have more than everybody in the world combined for operational theater and interballistic missiles. And then you start saying, hey, India, Pakistan, Israel, you got to get rid of these nukes. And if you don't get rid of them, we're not giving you the billions of dollars we always give you. So we're kind of blackmailing them. Then what we should do when they get rid of them, stop giving them money anyway. But it's something like that. I mean, I'm just making it up as I go along. But unless we're just totally screwed, unless we're going to live like this through the rest of our existence, and I don't think it can. I think that if we keep trying to live like this militaristically and politically with the incredible poverty, with everything that is the major definitions of the modern world, I mean, you know, any number of us listening, I do, have a pretty decent life. I never read the paper and weren't aware of a lot of the threats. I'd think, gee, life is sweet. But there's billions of people for which life is misery, and there's billions of people more that life is a struggle, including in this country, and none of it has to be like this. And we don't have to live under threat of disease. We don't have to live under threat of environmental collapse. We don't have to live under threat of military and nuclear catastrophe. But, and you say, well, what do we do? All right, well, we have to get mobilized. Thank you to Deborah listening in Detroit, who reminds me that the opposite of a progressive tax is a regressive tax. Gee, that was tough on my part, wasn't it? Okay, right. So, like, gambling is a regressive tax on the poor, essentially. All right, all right, all right. Let's get Howard and Grand Blanc. Howard, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Pete. How you doing?
Doing good, thanks.
Hey, 9/11 again.
Sure.
During that few hours or hour before the attacks, those planes were lost on radar. Have you heard the story on that?
I have, but you might mention it again.
Well, supposedly the CIA is what way I hear it. Dick Cheney was running the CIA drill of the exact thing that happened. And none of the air controllers knew if it was the drill or if it was a real thing. So that gave the opportunity to lose the planes and probably switch planes. So those were,
well,
the flights that we've heard that were in the...
Yeah, your call's breaking up pretty badly. Let me suggest that, again, I don't know if you caught my website, whether you have access to the Internet, but it's peterwerby.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E, W-E-R-B as in boy, E. Go to the left column, go where it says, you got a, it says 911 Bush New, and click on that. And there's a video there that's called, There Must Have Been a Military Order. In other words, to get the planes to stand down. And it's pretty chilling. Again, I put it up there for your consideration. Is it true? I don't know. All right, thanks a lot. Got to get my last caller. Jethro, hi, you're on the air. Are you there?
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, yeah, great. Hey, my old buddy Perry with the comb over, man.
What?
Oh, I don't know. I must have been mistaken. But anyways, Pete.
Yeah.
He, away on my name's Jethro.
Yeah, hi.
Okay, great. I actually got an idea, and this is scary. We could actually print up T-shirts here in Southwest Detroit saying, I got bushwhacked into Iraq.
I like that.
Yeah, and it provides jobs and jobs.
This is WRIF.com.
Tired of expensive phone bills? Standard phone service can cost a minimum of $30. And for the unlimited packages, it's anywhere from $40 to $70. After adding all the taxes and fees, the question is it really worth it? I'd like to introduce you to Corecom's new product, Voice Over Internet Protocol, or simply VoIP. This innovation allows you to talk to anyone around the world by using your broadband internet connection. With its advanced features, VoIP is revolutionizing telephone service as we know it today. Even more exciting is that this can all be done at a fraction of the price of traditional phone service. Why would you pay more when you can pay less? If you've got high-speed internet access, Corecom can offer you a package for as low as $15.99 per month. When was the last time your phone company offered you any package options that low? As an added bonus, if you call within the next 10 minutes, Corecom will throw in 1 month free. All you have to do is call 1-866-680-CORE. That's 1-866-680-CORE. Call now and mention promotion code WRIF, or if you register online, type in promotion code WRIF to get your free month. Corecom, revolutionizing phone service one call at a time.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
Hi, this is Colleen McDonald, president of Holiday Automotive Group. You know us as Holiday Chevrolet in Farmington Hills, Livonia Chrysler Jeep in Livonia, and Century Dodge in Taylor. We know it's never fun to have to bring your car in for service, and worse yet, if you've been in an accident. But rest assured, our service staff is here and ready to help you. To make an appointment, go online at weloveholiday.com. It's that easy.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
We also have special discounts if you need body work on your vehicle and accept all insurance companies. Call us at 866-867-0909 for more information. We're the Holiday Automotive Group. We've got you covered from Downriver to Oakland County.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best Riff Rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff Rock.
WRIF.com.
University. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you, and it's also a pleasure to bring back to our microphones Paul Krasner. You may remember Paul over the years for the interviews I've done with him. He's published a number of a collection of his essays, and I'm looking through all the books that he's written. I think the last one was The Winner of the Slow Bicycle Race, The Satirical Writings of Paul Krasner, and I'm looking...
There was one between that and the new one, and that was called Murder at the Conspiracy Convention, which had an introduction by George Carlin.
Paul Krasner, welcome. And also Confessions of a Raving Unconfined Nut, Misadventures in the Counterculture. And Paul Krasner is the only person in the world to ever have won awards from both Playboy for satire and the Feminist Party Media Workshop for journalism. And you were inducted into the Counterculture Hall of Fame at the Cannabis Cup in Amsterdam and received an ACLU Uppie for Upton Sinclair Award for dedication to the freedom of expression. You edited, this doesn't sound real, you edited the Realist magazine from 1958 to 2001.
Well, there was an 11-year hiatus at one point, so people thought they just were lapsing in their subscriptions.
But, of course, the Realists kind of set the stage for many of the censorship battles. And, in fact, what was in there at the time was so over the top that it drew, just like George Carlin, just like your friend Lenny Bruce, drew cops, you know, everybody that that said no to Paul Krasner. Tell us a little about the Realists, and tell us about, as you were telling me before the show, about a reissue.
Not of the Realists. That's retired. But in 1967, we published, it was a few months after Disney had died, Walt Disney, and I felt that, you know, now he was a real intelligent designer. But when he died, it was as if their creator had disappeared, the one who had kept them inhibited, all their baser emotions all those years. And so I assigned Wally Wood, who was the first artist that I met at Mad Magazine, to do the Disneyland Memorial Orgy, which would be all of his characters who had been in suspended animation suddenly having an old-fashioned Roman binge orgy. And so that was in black and white. And then just recently, I republished it, but on better paper, larger, suitable for framing, digitally colored by a former Disney employee. So if people want to get a look at that, it's on my website, paulkrasner.com.
You know, Paul Krasner, we should say that we're going to be talking to you about your new collection of essays. It's called One Hand Jerking, Reports from an Investigative Satirist. Is satire, how do you do satire anymore? It could almost be some of what like Lenny Bruce used to do, just almost read from the daily papers. I mean, how do you...
Oh, well, not only, you know, for decades now, reality has been nipping at the heels of satire and occasionally surpasses it. You know, most recently... Now, this was not me as a satirist who said this. This was a serious statement by a creationist who said that there was a pair of dinosaurs on Noah's Ark. Now, I would like to have had the satirical imagination to come up with that, but you know, it's a reality in their minds to kind of rationalize the irreconcilability between science and religion.
Well, actually, that's a serious question worth investigating. Not the dinosaurs, but the idea of satire. Satire, of course, over the last 300 or 400 years, was this tool in the hands of non-official writers to criticize the powers that be, because very frequently you couldn't do it directly. Now, as you said, where it's difficult to be more radical than reality or more crazy than reality, I mean that very seriously. Is it a challenge?
It's certainly a challenge, but you know, that's the fun of it, because as in any endeavor, if there's a challenge that you meet, it's very satisfying. So, you know, for me, I was responding to the indictment of Scooter Libby, and I thought, you know, now that there's more certainty that Karl Rove might be next, and then maybe Andrew Card and George Bush and Judy Miller and Patrick Fitzgerald, all of them. But I sum that up by saying that there are so many asses being covered in Washington now that it looks like a Christo art project.
Everybody, I think, knows that's the guy that covers everything with these huge cloths. Yeah, no, that's great. You know, tell us too, one of your more famous projects, I guess you could call it, was the poster you made, the very patriotic poster in the middle of the Cold War that I can't say the whole word, but people will know what it is, that said F communism. Tell us the story of that, Paul, and why it was so difficult for the usual censorial sources to say no to it.
Well, you know, the context of that poster was at the peak of the Cold War. I mean, there was Alvin Dark, who was a manager of some baseball team, made a statement that anybody who hits a batter, any pitcher who hits a batter, is a communist. You know, that was the worst thing you could say about him. The Communist Party itself was criticized for not using a zip code in their address. Pat Boone at Madison Square Garden said he would rather see his four daughters die in the fires of hell rather than being indoctrinated by the Communist Party. I mean, there was such a hysteria about it. And so I took had this poster made in red, white, and blue. The word bleep was with stars and stripes, and the word communism was red with hammers and sickles. And you know, the post office tried to give me problems with it, and I met with one of their officials, and I said, "Well, look, do you want the post office to be known as pro-communist?" So some student at a Midwestern college held it up for the senior class graduation photo in the yearbook, and before it could go to press, the administration saw it and said, "You know, the alumni will see that and say, what are we giving our donations to?" So they bleeped out the word bleep. They whited it out.
Yeah.
And airbrushed it out in the photo. So now the guy was just holding up a sign that said communism. So they had to bleep that out. And so now in some yearbook, there's this senior graduating class where a guy's holding up a blank poster.
Yeah.
And, you know, he must have majored in Dada.
Paul Krasner is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. The new book from Seven Stories Press, you can go to sevenstories.com to get more about it, or check out your local independent bookstore. It's the collection's called One Hand Jerking Reports from an Investigative Satirist. And it's amazing the list of publications that have published these you know, all of these essays, and I don't mean that it's amazing that they would accept them, but it's amazing that there's such a wide range that's open to satire of this nature, whereas before you literally had to publish your own magazine, The Realist, to make it happen.
Yeah, I think the Internet made a difference in that, you know. My original goal was to put myself out of business in the sense of doing whatever I could to liberate communication, you know, to have communication without compromise. And that is happening on the Internet now. You know, that old saying about freedom of the press belongs to those who have a press. And, you know, not that everybody can afford a computer or wants to go online, but if you read the newspapers and the magazines and listen to the radio and television, for the most part, you get a kind of filtered down version of what's really happening. And then if you compare that with what you can find on the Internet in alternative and foreign publications, there's two separate worlds, you know, and, mm-hmm. And it can be very schizophrenic, you know, with having one foot in mainstream culture and the other in, the truth.
In your book, One Hand Jerking, you have an essay about your friend Lenny Bruce, and actually you can remind us, too, where this first appeared.
This is one of the longest pieces in the book. It's called The Ballad of Lenny the Lawyer.
Right.
And it's a 5,000-word essay that served as the liner notes for a 6-CD Lenny Bruce anthology and earlier this year. And so it was nominated for a Grammy Award as in the Best Album Notes category. I didn't even know there was such a category.
No, me neither.
But
well, good. Now I'm looking at it here. The co-authors of the book, The Trials of Lenny Bruce, Ronald Collins and David Scover. I interviewed actually Ronald Collins about the book. They were ones that helped to present this petition that finally cleared comic and satirist Lenny Bruce from the charges that he had been convicted of in New York. And this is the beginning of your essay, The Ballad of Lenny, the Lawyer. Why did Lenny Bruce get chewed up in the way he did, whereas people like yourself, who was always out there on the edge, George Carlin, why did they survive? What was it about Lenny Bruce that he ran up on the shoals of repression?
Well, the you know, it started with one arrest, and then the word got around that, you know, it was people like to arrest celebrities, and his irreverence was applied to organized religion, politicians, a lot of stuff that was held sacred in the culture, and there were no laws, for example, against blasphemy, but when one of his earliest bits was Religions Incorporated, where all of these evangelists and preachers gathered around a big boardroom table, like a conference corporate executives. And so it was very irreverent towards organized religion, and one of Lenny's lines was that people are leaving the church and going back to God.
he
even questioned the nature of God, you know, talking about, well, what color is God? Is Asian, Caucasian, you know? But there were no blasphemy laws, and so they got him on obscenity, even though cops admitted and district attorneys admitted that that they were just using that as an excuse to bust him. But he, because of his trials and because of the way the culture has evolved, he was a pioneer. He opened the doors for comedians now who have the freedom that he wanted, which was to speak as freely on stage as he would in his living room. And I just covered for The Nation magazine a comedy festival in Las Vegas. And they, and all those guys know that they owe a debt to Lenny. That Robert Klein was there, and he said he was good, and he was funny, and he was, and he talked about social issues, which is he considered the highest form of comedy. And so now, what Lenny said in the, in those days in the '60s would not be as shocking as the fact that he got busted for using language that now is commonplace.
Mm-hmm. Even on television, even on cable television.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Lenny Bruce died of an overdose of morphine. Is there any thought that it was self-inflicted purposely?
That was one of the things under consideration, because he had just been evicted, or his home was going to go under foreclosure, and he couldn't get work because he had been busted so many times, and nightclubs were afraid to hire him. And he was broke and owed money, and but he still was fighting in the courts. He sent me a postcard which had a doodle of Jesus on the cross saying, "Where the hell is the ACLU?"
Mm-hmm.
And so. One might have thought that, except I came to the conclusion it was an accidental overdose, because at that time there was heroin going around Hollywood that was not cut with talcum powder or whatever they use, and so what might be a regular dose for somebody could be, in effect, an overdose. And his electric typewriter was still humming.
Hmm.
And it was in the middle of the word. He said something like the Fourth Amendment, CONST, it stopped in the middle of the word constitutes. So, and tea was boiling on the stove. So, so from that I concluded that it was accidental. But I even for a while thought it was, you know, it might have been, what do they call it? The police, they have this word for it, anyway, it means a crime has been committed.
No, oh, yeah.
And homicide in this case. But the more I investigated it, the more I learned that and came to the conclusion that it was accidental.
Paul Krasner, in your book, One Hand Jerking, you've got a nice introduction by Lewis Black of The Daily Show and a foreword by Harry Shearer of the Simpsons. These pals of yours, how did you wind up with work by them introducing your collection of essays?
Oh, well, Harry Shearer is an old friend, and I've substituted on his Le Show, syndicated satirical broadcast, a few times. And we were in a show together once. Peter Bergman from the Firesign Theater and me and Harry Shearer, because the show could then be called Peter, Paul, and Harry. And we were at the MoCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art,
uh-huh,
in L.A. And then Lewis Black, I learned that he had been very much influenced by the realist, that it was a turning point in how he dealt with the world. And so I felt free to ask him if he would write the introduction, and he was happy to do it. And you know, it's, I mean, you write, you have introductions by people sometimes, not to say, hello, this is Paul's book, but to get their names on the cover so that people who appreciate their work are likely to investigate what they're praising.
I know one of the essays in your book is about pornography, and that's another curious sort of something that was kept so far in the background. And I mean, 30, 40 years ago, even they had smokers for men and stag parties, and now every once in a while you can walk in somebody's house and they've got the Playboy channel on, and there it all is, right out there. And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier. How do you, I mean, is it, I don't even know if it's possible to be an outlaw anymore. I mean, remember, there's a difference between being a criminal and an outlaw, I think.
No, that's Peter, that's an excellent distinction, because you know, as in, say in the case of drugs, any my position is that any government that can arbitrarily decide which drugs are legal and which drugs are illegal, then people in prison for drug indictments are political prisoners. So, yeah, they certainly would be outlaws rather than criminals. It's a matter of wait. What was your question about? Just talking about drugs got me
killed. You had a flashback. I don't know. The fact that it's hard to be an outlaw. Everything that was once suppressed, other than drugs, has now become sort of mainstream, like language, like pornography.
I'll tell you, they're trying. The devil never sleeps. I mean, even now there's a debate going on in the legislature that cable television, I mean, you know, pornography is a $20 billion industry now. And so now, and this country was founded by Puritans and by pioneers. And so those two streaks of permissiveness versus control have evolved along with everything else, and are in a raging battle now, so it's why there are people, legislators, who want to have the same rules for cable that don't apply really, that the FCC does apply to regular television and radio.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
So you know, it's just a matter. They have this urge to control what other people think and do and watch, it's just they're control freaks. It boils down to that.
Well, it's clear what side you're on, Paul Krasner, because on the cover of your book, One Hand Jerking, describe what you're wearing and what you're holding and all that. I think that'll give people an idea. You're sort of the devil's advocate.
No, I'm the devil with advocate. That all started when I moved to this small town, Desert Hot Springs in California, and a friend of mine was the head of the Chamber of Commerce, and they asked me to perform at the installation dinner. And they had a heavenly theme, so they asked me to get into a devil's costume to be thrown out of the kitchen instead of out of heaven. And then I could do a roast, you know, so I did like a roast of the audience instead of the other way around. I would tell the mayor that don't worry, the meth lab that he wanted has been there and he'll get the $3 million very shortly. So, you know, being in a devil's costume, I could do things that I had never played a character before, but I could say things that I wouldn't get away with if I were not wearing the devil's costume. And so, you know, and there was a woman in the hallway when I was pacing back and forth before I went on, and they had at the same hotel, they had had some kind of seminar. And so I heard her say to her companion, "I would sell my soul to get a massage." So I just tapped her on the shoulder, and I said, "Just sign right here." And it was a great moment, Peter. I'll tell you, it was. It should have been preserved in amber for posterity.
Well, I would like to see the expressions on some people's faces when I saw the cover of this book. You're dressed in a devil's outfit. You're giving the devil sign. You have a trident. I mean, to me, it's humorous. I think other people that see the devil as having direct intervention or participation in worldly affairs, it might kind of freak them out. But I know that wouldn't bother you, would it?
25% of the population in America believes literally in a satanic figure like that.
That's all? That's wonderful.
Okay.
I mean, really?
Right, because it's almost 50% that don't believe in evolution.
Oh, my Lord.
Or that do believe in evolution. But in any case, it's great to hear these debates about God that we used to have in our college bull sessions.
Now out in the open.
Now official pundits. Everything's coming out in the open. You know, Karl Rove used to be like a flasher in the park, coming out once in a while. But now he's just standing out in the middle of the road, opening his raincoat and go, "Hey, lady, here I am."
Hey, I should confess. Pardon me, that line about outlaws and criminals, I stole that. You remember there was a film, like a 1970 film called Steelyard Blues with Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland?
Oh, I do remember that, especially because a friend of mine, Gary Goodrow, was in it, and he was going to play a pickpocket. And I had a radio program in San Francisco then, and he called and asked if there were any pickpockets who could give him advice and a pickpocket called me, and it was a real thrill to be able to act as a switchboard and get them together.
Well, at one point, Jane Fonda says to Sutherland, he says, "You're nothing but a criminal." And he says, "I am not. I'm an outlaw." And she says, "What's the difference?" And he says, "I don't know."
Well, you know, I think, isn't it in the Dylan song, to be an outlaw, you must be honest.
Yeah, that's right.
And I guess the unspoken other shoe is to be a criminal, you must get away with it.
What are you writing now? Anything, all the events that are happening now? I mean, there's a lot of shoes. You kind of indicated before about people covering their butts. A lot of these butts are going to become uncovered real quickly, I think. And are you just kind of figuratively with your pen poised in the air?
Well, I do an occasional blog for Ariane Huffington's website. And but my big project is working on a novel, and it's about a contemporary Lenny Bruce type performer, everything that I develop on stage as a stand-up, not everything, but a lot of it will end up coming out of the mouth of my protagonist. So I find myself sometimes resenting this imaginary character who's stealing my material.
No.
It's a very schizophrenic process.
You said we missed interviewing you about Murder at the Conspiracy Convention and Other American Absurdities. Was that a novel or was that a collection also?
Oh, that was a collection.
So
I'm the king of rehash.
Well, that's good.
Now, this is my first novel.
Oh.
I said Avery Corman, who wrote Oh God and Kramer versus Kramer, is an old friend, and I asked him, I said, "Boy, writing fiction is hard. You have to make everything up."
Yeah.
And he said, "Come on, Paul, you've been making up stuff all your life." And I said, "Yeah, but that was journalism."
Well, you're in grand company. Paul Krasner has been my guest in the Peter Werby Show. His brand new collection of essays, each one of them pretty funny and also hard-hitting. Also, right to the core of many of the contemporary issues.
Oh, well, I appreciate that feedback, I will tell you.
All right, and the subtitle, Reports from an Investigative Satirist, I think that's, and that's S-A-T-I-R-I-S-T. There are other sort of satires and all that, but...
Oh, yeah, with a Y.
That's right.
That's only in my devil's costume.
This is published by Seven Stories Press. You can go to sevenstories.com. Paul Krasner, thanks for joining me as usual.
Okay, take care, Peter.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Every successful career has a beginning. Have you started yours yet? Turbocharge your opportunities by calling ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-903-1919. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. If you have an interest in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design, they teach skills that many employers look for. Most programs provide a hands-on education and can help you build your knowledge base and technical skills. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Develop technical skills at an ITT Tech and discover a whole new world of opportunity. Call now for a brochure at 1-800-903-1919. That's ITT Tech, 1-800-903-1919. 1-800-903-1919. 101 WRIF and Media Play present the Free You College Giveaway. Use your MasterCard or complete an entry form at Media Play, and you could win a one-time payment of $150,000 towards college tuition. No purchase necessary. Ends December 31st, 2005. Open to U.S. residents 18 or older. For rules and alternate entry details, visit your Media Play store today or log on MediaPlay.com or WRIF.com. Media Play with locations in Livonia, Utica, Taylor, Clinton Township, and Ann Arbor.
This is WRIM.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF. WRIF
reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Good morning, thank you very much for joining me. Those of you who have listened to the broadcast over the years know that that a concern I have, and I share with many of you, hopefully with most of you, is a concern for our environment. And from time to time, it's good to get a look into what's going on in the natural world itself, the assault on it by human beings, and government policy, how that affects it all as well. And there's a very important book that's just come out. It's called Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forests, and it's co-written by Derek Jensen and George Draffen. And Derek Jensen is our guest, and Derek Jensen is the author of The Culture of Make-Believe, A Language Older Than Words, Listening to the Land, and co-author of Railroads and Clear Cuts. Derek Jensen, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you're where? You're up in British Columbia.
No, actually, I'm in far northern California.
Okay.
In Crescent City, which is on the coast and right on the border of Oregon. So I'm about 5 minutes from old growth redwoods and 5 minutes from the ocean.
What does it look like there? Because every once in a while, I think, you know, if you didn't have the information like is presented in Strangely Like War that you co-authored, you could see grand forests and woods, and, you know, one goes hiking, and, you know, it doesn't look so bad.
Well, two things about that. One is that, yes, there are places that are like that, but they're remnants. I mean, it's like 95% of the ancient forest on this continent is gone, and I don't remember the numbers exactly, but it's essentially like 90% of the native forest on the planet's gone, 80%. It's a large number. And in some countries, all of it's gone. And the forests that remain are, for the most part, pretty remote. I mean, I live in a county that has, that for the United States is pretty remote. There's, I think, 15,000 people in the county, of whom 4,000 are prisoners at Pelican Bay State Prison. So there's 11,000 non-prisoners in this county. And so there is some forest that still remains here. And so, I mean, walking through those forests is an extraordinarily wonderful experience. And actually, it's all very problematical, too, because the other day, just maybe 2 weeks ago, I was out in the forest, and we're in this place called Mill Creek, and I saw about 15 coho salmon spawning. And I mean, it really brought tears to my eyes because it's so beautiful. And at the same time, it brought tears to my eyes because I've seen pictures and I've read accounts of what it was like prior to the arrival of our culture, where there would be, and the pictures I've seen are of Alaska now, where it's literally so thick that if you step in the water, you would step on a fish. And
wow.
I'm so excited to see 15 now. And that's sort of how I feel about all the forests, is that, you know, there still is this great beauty left, but it's pretty rare. And the other thing I want to say very quickly about that is that oftentimes people drive down roads and they can say, wow, there, you know, the forest looks really nice, but that's because there are these things called beauty strips, which are, they intentionally leave strips near roads so that you can't see the clear cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just walk, you know, 200 yards or 50 yards even through that, you'll come out on the other side and see just a moonscape. And well, that's actually in Oregon, things have gotten so bad that they're now cutting the beauty strips.
Well, Derek Jensen, where I live in a big metropolitan area, the Detroit area, and you know, the small suburb, I live in a fairly small suburb, and you know, there's like four times as many people as in your whole county, and yet all I have to do is travel 20 minutes, and I go to what we call a metro park, and there's lots of big trees. They were planted in the 1920s as part of you know, the government forestation project, maybe the 1930s, probably part of that, all that. And, yeah, I mean, so we've cut down all the trees, people would say. So what? You know, there's the, you know, there's trees, there's you know, birds are living in them. What's the problem here?
Well, one of the things that we need to remember is that forests, there's a difference between a bunch of trees standing somewhere and a functioning forest. That a forest is not just a group of trees. It's a collection of creatures living in relationship to each other where they're actually benefiting each other. And so you can see a hillside. There are pretty famous pictures of, you know, a hillside of just monocrop of Douglas firs or something that have been planted out here. And that's essentially, I mean, even though it looks prettier, it's essentially like a cornfield. And from the perspective of anybody else living on the planet, then these, I mean, sure, we may walk into a bunch of trees and say, wow, this looks really pretty. And it sure will look pretty, but it's still not a forest. And the other thing to say about that is that there are no forests on the planet anywhere that have survived longer than three rotations. And what that means is if you cut the trees three times, then right now the Black Forest in Europe is dying in part because of acid rain, but also because it's on its third rotation. And you just keep taking the nutrients out, and you kill the soil. And when you kill the soil, it's all over. So those trees may be fine. Those trees may be fine, but it's not going to last.
Mm-hmm. Now, this all began a long time ago. Gilgamesh cut down the ancient cedar forest of Mesopotamia, and there's some Gilgamesh on my block as we speak, cutting down three 100-year-old oaks because they produce too many leaves. So tree cutting goes back pretty far into human history.
Well, it's really, you know, the Gilgamesh story is really the first written story of our culture, and it's a story of how he cut down. And we all see these pictures of what's going on over in Iraq now, and a lot of it, I mean, when I think of the sort of Middle East and then into the Near East, I always picture just these barren hillsides with maybe some scrub on it. But the truth is that much of the Arabian Peninsula was an oak forest, and much of what is now Iraq was filled with cedars so thick that the sunlight never touched the ground. And really our culture, there's this line that forests precede us and deserts dog our heels. And you can see this all over the world. Not humans, because there were humans living in North America for thousands of years at the very least who didn't deforest. It's our particular way of life that has been deforesting civilization. You know, and there were lions in Greece. And Aristotle was writing about how, about deforestation. And, I mean, it goes way back in our culture, and it's continuing with this imperative. And a lot of it is based on this perception that you just mentioned a moment ago, that we can cut down trees and still have, you know, a living hillside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really short-sighted, and by now, I mean, it's a short-sighted way of perceiving the world. And by now, we should know better. We have 6,000 years of history to look at. And who was it who defined insanity as doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result?
Well, I guess the only thing of what you said so far that I don't think is entirely responsive to what I was presenting is that what are the consequences? I mean, we all live here on the planet. We've got big cities. We've got, you know, even if we got 5% of the old forest, you know, you did talk about the problem of three plantings, but one, maybe, you know, we could stop after two. I mean, what? And if this has been going on for 2,000 or 3,000 years, you know, it looks like it's sustainable.
Well, that was the point I was trying to make about the Middle East, is that it was at one point forested, and it's no longer forested. It's not coming back. And so it seems to me that what you're asking is, why should we care?
Right, exactly.
Well, one of the reasons is because of it's simply wrong to deforest, and it's simply wrong to drive salmon extinct. But if we're going to stay within the sort of utilitarian worldview, you know, salmon, for example, were a major, major economic resource. And, you know, the fisheries are gone now in the Pacific. The salmon fisheries are gone in the Pacific Northwest. And mm-hmm. that's a huge economic cost to the commercial fisheries, or commercial fishermen. And so on that level, that's something to care about. And global warming, I mean, of course, trees are a major sink for, or forests are a major sink for carbon. And that's, once again, but I'm a little bit hesitant to use, and then we've all heard the arguments, of course, about how, you know, cutting down the rainforest is killing all these medicinal plants that people can use to save what, you know, save themselves from this or that disease. And we can make those arguments, but I'm not really comfortable using them because they don't challenge the underlying utilitarian worldview, this underlying worldview that everything exists in the world for our use,
yeah.
which is just really nasty, for one thing. And the end point, and I've written about this in my book, The Culture of Make-Believe, I mean, the end point of utilitarian worldview really is assembly line mass murder, because if you perceive the world as to how you can use it, the world will congeal for you into four groups, and that's the people like you who are allowed to consume everything in their path. And the second group is those you want to exploit, and it's best if you can exploit them through, get them to exploit themselves through the rhetoric of production. You know, what's wrong with you? You're not productive. You know, why don't you get a job? Are you lazy?
Mm-hmm.
If that doesn't work, you point a gun at them. And the third group is those who resist, and those are, you need to kill them spectacularly to stop other people from resisting. And the fourth group is those who are simply extra, and that those are the ones who are on land that you know you could put to better use. And that was, you know, the Jews in World War II. That was the Slavs, the Russians. That's the Palestinians these days. That's the American Indians, the indigenous the world over. And that's almost all the natural world. Why are these trees on this land? You know, we could put this to economic use. And so my point is that, and the fourth group, the way you want to deal with them, if you're in this exploiting class, is you want to just get rid of them as quickly and easily as possible. And it's best if you can starve them or cut them down. I mean, I keep thinking about this line back from the Middle Ages about the Catholics killing heretics, which was kill them all and let God sort them out. And there's some arguments as to whether anybody actually said that. But
no, they said it in Vietnam as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing with clear-cutting. You know, kill them all and let economics sort them out. And it's the same thing with factory fishing or factory trawling, that, you know, kill them all and let economics sort them out there too. And that's a really, I mean, once again, on a utilitarian basis, it's really, really stupid. I mean, the timber industries, on the national forest, the timber programs in the national forest cost the American public more than they get back, which means that the American public is actually paying to deforest.
Subsidizing these big logging firms.
Yeah.
And paper firms. Yeah.
And, of course, you and I both know that capitalism is based on subsidies and it couldn't exist without subsidies. But
Derek Jensen, you're trying to say that we don't live in a free market system?
Oh, there's this great line by Duane Andreas, who was the former head of Archer Daniels Midland. And he said, I'm going to butcher this line, but basically he said, there's not one grain of anything that's in the world that's sold on the free market. It exists only in economic textbooks and the speech of the politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so my point is that it would be so cool, and this is never going to happen, but it would be so cool if they would just change the subsidies and even pay these nasty timber corporations to actually go in and reforest. It's all so silly. Oh, and as long as we're on this, there's one more little rant I want to make.
Please go ahead. Well, let me reintroduce you just to make sure that anyone who's just joining us knows who you are. Derek Jensen is the co-author of Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forests. It has a foreword by Vandana Shiva, a woman from India, which I want to ask Derek about in just a minute. And it's published by Chelsea Green Publishing. You can go to Chelsea, that's C-H-E-L-S-E-A, green.com. Yes, another rant, please.
Which is, I'm sure you heard in the 90s about the big jobs versus owls debate.
Sure, whether or not, they were saying you couldn't cut down these forests on California because a spotted owl lived there, and these people were saying, hey, you're going to be destroying jobs for some little owl.
Right, and Washington and Oregon, too. And the thing is, the whole debate was just nonsense because it really should have been jobs versus automation, raw log exports, because all through the 80s and 90s, the cut had gone up. And the number of jobs had gone down because of automation primarily. And so any journalist with a shred of integrity would have not framed it as jobs versus owls, but instead would have framed it as jobs versus automation. Productivity in paper mills went up, productivity in sawmills went up, and jobs went down. And so it's all just nonsense, which reminds me, one more rant here, is that I'm sure you've heard also about Bush's Healthy Forest Initiative.
Yeah, he cares. He says he wants to.
Yeah. And the thing that's really interesting about this is that there's Robert J. Lifton, who's probably the world's foremost authority on the psychology of genocide, made very clear that before you can commit any awful act, that you have to commit, you have to convince yourself and others that what you're doing is not harmful, but instead beneficial. And we see that with the Healthy Forest Initiative. They can't say, we want to hand over these trees to the big timber companies. Instead, they have to come up with a what Robert J. Lifton called a claim to virtue. And that's true here, that the whole debate is really, in some ways, very frustrating, because it's all based on lies and all based mm-hmm. on nonsense.
Well, actually, if I can quote off of my own website, peterwerby.com, Voltaire's quote from the 18th century, anyone who has the power to make you believe absurdities has the power to make you commit injustices. And
a wonderful line.
Yeah, and part of it is, I mean, that's the value of books like yours, Derek Jensen, Strangely Like War, is that it gives people the information, because you have the masters of deceit, the masters of disinformation. Like, well, I was actually just getting an email criticism from a reader who said I was what a hypocrite I was, because I was calling Rush Limbaugh Pillhead Limbaugh, and asking why do you think they call him Rush. But he really is the master of disinformation. And one of the things that he says is that, hey, in any given year, there's more trees being planted than cut down. So don't worry about it, folks. Huh?
Well, do you want me to respond to that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, a couple of responses. The first one is that he's conflating things that aren't the same. And it is not only absurd but obscene to compare a 2,000-year-old tree that is, I mean, that's been alive for longer than our culture has been on this continent by four times, to compare that to a seedling. And that's the first thing. And the second thing is, he's once again comparing apples and oranges by comparing a forest to a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And in any case, it's really absurd. Why don't we just say, you know what, there are more babies born every day than people killed, so why don't we just shoot you in the head?
Well, the other thing is, of course, in an area where you may, an old growth area, or you know, 100, 200, 500, 2,000-year-old trees, and if you cut down 100 of them, there's probably space enough to put in 10,000 seedlings. And you go, well, God, what a, you know, look at this, look at the ratio you have there. So another quote I'm fond of is from a social commentator around 1900, Mr. Dooley, who said that figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
Mm.
And I think that's what we're looking at here. Well, I mentioned that the foreword to your wonderful book, Strangely Like War, is written by Vandana Shiva. And tell us the importance of Vandana Shiva as it connects to forest issues.
Well, she's probably the most important Indian activist and writer, Indian activist right now. By which I mean person from India, not American Indian. And she's been working on forest issues and also dam issues, water issues. I mean, they're all interrelated, and they're interrelated here, too. And she's been working on those issues over there for many, many years. And Strangely Like War is not really, I mean, it's not simply about American forests. It's also about globalization, because it's impossible to talk about deforestation without talking about the economic system. And one of the things that's driving a lot of deforestation is the whole global interconnectedness with, you know, destroying the forests of Indonesia so that people in Japan can have plywood for their concrete forms, and so her importance to the book is that she is one of the foremost critics of globalization, foremost authorities on how globalization works and how it harms especially the poor and the natural world.
Now, wasn't she also, like, the original tree hugger? I mean, that's used as this derogatory remark. It's said with contempt by these people who seem to delight in destruction, our friends on the right. And am I remembering her that she was part of this movement that actually, that women went out and surrounded these trees and hugged them?
That movement actually goes back, I'm making up the number, but I'm going to say 500 years. It might be 200 years. I mean, it goes back hundreds of years, we can say that, in India. It's called the Chipko Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that was... it began with women who did not want the forests of their region to be cut. And so they would actually go out and put their bodies between the tree and the axe and hug the tree. And, you know, people talk about, you know, oh, those hippies these days who are, you know, trying to do civil disobedience to stop, you know, the cutting of the forest. Well, we got the Chipko movement, and then also this has been going on for a long time. There's Founders Grove of Redwoods, which is south of Hereaways, and the reason that was saved is because this woman in her 50s went out and laid down in front of the people with the saws back around 1910, 1905, something like that,
mm-hmm.
and Stout Grove, where I was just at with Mill Creek with the old growth within 5 minutes of me, that was saved because a bunch of elderly women... went out and fought to save it. And, I mean, there's a long history of, and I guess all these things I'm mentioning are women. There's a long history of women and men, you know, fighting to stop this deforestation.
Well, oftentimes when I get email from right-wing critics, they call me, you tree-hugging, and I think, well, you know, why is that an insult? And so I do that. I want to be everything they accuse me of, everything that they hate. So, I mean, I want to hug trees. I want to dodge the draft. Whatever. I want to burn my bra. I want to marry a guy. You know, I mean, anything just to say, hey, you know, people make certain choices. Well, never mind.
Well, have you literally hugged trees, by the way?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's actually quite a wonderful thing, not to get too woo-woo about this.
Let's go woo-woo.
It's a wonderful, and I've written about this, it's actually quite a wonderful feeling. Whenever I'm in town, I always, when I walk by trees, I always touch them and tell them I'm sorry that they're imprisoned in concrete.
okay, good.
And the other thing, if I'm going to mention this, if you ever come to the West, find a ponderosa pine, and go up and put your nose in between the creases in the bark and smell it. They smell so good. They smell like a combination of vanilla and cinnamon.
I haven't actually done that, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they have them northern New Mexico. They're these mm-hmm. kind of ponderosas. Yeah, all right. So here, we're in Detroit City and all that. So we'll back up from the woo-woo. But, you know, there's very few people. I mean, there are some, you know, that don't like trees, that don't understand the importance of forests, very few people that do not understand the importance of mm-hmm. habitation and all of that. The social forces that are, you know, the scythe that are cutting more and more trees, and I learned from your book, Strangely Like War, that how much of the deforestation, the logging, is illegal in the world and also here in the United States.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Internationally, I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but I believe it's about 50%, isn't it?
I think it's in your book, yeah.
Yeah, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% of all the logging in the world is just illegal. So people talk about, oh, there's great regulations. Well, big deal. And then the other part about that is that both in the United States and around the world, timber theft is not very high on the list of prosecutable items. It's something that doesn't happen very often. In fact, there was a timber theft task force was assembled by the Forest Service several years ago, and they discovered all sorts of Operation Rodeo, I believe it was called, and they were finding that many, many of the big corporations were just stealing wholesale from the federal government, which of course is not a surprise. I mean, that's how things work in, you know, military procurement and all that stuff too. So it's no surprise they're stealing from the feds. They're stealing from the public, really, is what it means. Anyway, when the task force started to close in on them, first off, the Forest Service started shredding documents like mad and was going out and changing contracts to retroactively to make it so. And the way they were stealing is that they would have a boundary where they could cut, and then, of course, they would go across the boundary and cut beyond that. Or they would put one type, more expensive type of tree, below on the logging truck, and then they would put the top would be a cheaper tree. And they would mess with the log scales, all that stuff, the weigh scales. Anyway, that's what the local Forest Service people did because they didn't want to harm their relationship with the corporate people they were working with. And then what the feds did, and this went all the way up to the White House, and there are beliefs that Clinton was actually gave the specific order to do this, that they actually disbanded the Timber Theft Task Force. And as always, they said, oh, we're doing this to streamline it and make it better, blah, blah, blah. But they gutted it, and then nowadays its prosecutions are limited to thefts of, I think, $5,000, which is, you know, the effect of, I mean, that's basically people stealing Christmas trees and firewood and stuff.
We don't have a lot of time left, and I don't know why lately I've gotten so sensitive to my conservative critics. Not like I'm going to act in terms of what they say, but I am always thinking about arguments to the contrary.
Right.
One of the things that they say is that all they ever get out of my shows is complaints and how bad everything is, and I think things are pretty bad in terms of our environment. And what about, in fact, well, maybe I usually end shows with quotes from the back of the book. People have endorsed it, and the wonderful Frances Moore LePay, who co-authored a book that kind of, in a lot of ways, brought me into all of this, Diet for a Small Planet. She says, your passion and your hard, cruel facts give us courage to imagine another possibility and to act. Well, I mean, on my website it says another world is possible, but our forces seem so minute compared to the social and economic forces that are just bound and determined to clear-cut the world. What do we have a chance?
Do we have a chance for what?
To stop these planet rapers, essentially.
I think the first, and it's like a lot of American Indian friends say to me, that the first and most important thing that we need to do is decolonize our minds. And we need to, what that means to me is that we need to, first off, recognize that it is an atrocity. And then we need to gather together and to begin to oppose it. And there are people, I mean, there are tree sits all over the country that people don't know about. And there are people who are filing, you know, lawsuits. And there are people who are acting in all sorts of ways. And that's one thing that I want to say. And another thing I want to say is a quote by a guy who was former head of security for South Africa during the apartheid years. And one of the things he said was that the most important thing that the ANC did, far more important even than the sabotage and violence, far more scary to them, was the notion that they would get people to disbelieve in the legitimacy of the forces of law and order. And the way that applies here is that one of the things I think is really important for all of us to do is to begin to recognize that the government really is acting as a government of occupation. I mean, what does the government of occupation do? It moves in, extracts resources, and does not act in the best interest of communities.
Let me, we actually are out of time. Let me, if this is kind of an odd way for me to sum up when it's your book, but in terms of the general issue, I think that I was remiss in not letting you clear some things up. Neither of us are talking about never cutting down a tree again. We're talking about sustainable forestry. We're talking about preserving large tracts of wild land as necessary for the inhabitants of the planet, both plant and animal, including ourselves. We're talking about looking at the world not through a model of profit, but rather through one that is what is best for the beings that inhabit the planet. And a lot of this could be brought about, first and foremost, by conservation, secondly, by recycling, and thirdly, our author's, our guest's book, Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forests, talks about, is finding out information. Anything you disagree with what I said? No?
I think that those are very, very small starts, and I think that we need to move beyond that. I think, once again, the first and most important thing is to simply recognize that, the first and most important thing is to fall in love with the salmon, to fall in love with the land where you live, and then to ask the land where you live what it needs, and to act in the best interest of the land in the long term. You know, American Indians cut down trees. But the big difference was that they recognize that they're going to be living somewhere for 500 years. And so the changes that they make in the landscape are going to benefit the landscape as a whole.
Now, the first thing to do, I would say, is get this book, Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forest. Derek Jensen has been our guest. He co-authored this with George Draffin, forward by Vandana Shiva, and it is published by Chelsea. That's C-H-E-L-S-E-A. Chelsea Green Publishing, chelseagreen.com. Derek Jensen, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you.
This is WRIM.com.
The lowdown on the hottest concerts in town are only a click away with a singular wireless concert connection. Log on to the concerts page right now at WRIF.com to find out where your favorite bands are appearing live in concert across the Motor City. Keep it right here on the Riff for your chance to text in to win tickets, backstage passes, autographed rock merchandise, and more. Exclusively on your singular wireless phone. The singular wireless concert connection from Singular Wireless, raising the bar at 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks. Rock, rock, rock.
101 WRIF and MediaPlay present the Free U College Giveaway. Use your MasterCard or complete an entry form at MediaPlay, and you could win a one-time payment of $150,000 towards college tuition. No purchase necessary. Ends December 31st, 2005. Open to U.S. residents 18 or older. For rules and alternate entry details, visit your MediaPlay store today or log on MediaPlay.com or WRIF.com. MediaPlay with locations in Livonia, Utica, Taylor, Clinton Township, and Ann Arbor.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 480.